need any help, Flo said. I work them TV guide crosswords every week. She went off with her coffee pot to a booth in back, where a chicken hawk in a white linen suit was trying to recruit a blonde boy fresh off the bus from St. Paul. The Java joint was on 42nd Street, between Times Square and the Port Authority bus terminal, sandwiched in between the Wet Pussycat Theater and an adult bookstore. The food wasn't quite up to aces high, but Jay liked the prices. Besides, it was a half a block from his office. He chewed on the pencil he bummed from Flo and looked at the list again. The original 19 finalists were down to 11. Snotman was in jail at the moment. He'd gone first. Most of the one-star candidates had followed in short order. Chrysalis's office wasn't big enough to hold an elephant, which eliminated Rada O'Reilly. Modular Man and Starshine had both made the list strictly on the basis of geography. Neither had any particular reason to want Chrysalis dead. Carnifex had been in Atlanta, as had Jack Braun. Jay knew Elmo hadn't done it, no matter how many stars the computer had assigned him. That left the list looking like this. Crenson, Croyd, the sleeper, 4 stars. Darlingfoot, John, Devil John, 3 stars. DeMarco, Ernest, Ernie the Lizard, 2 stars. Doe, John, Doughboy, 3 stars. Jones, Mordecai, the Harlem Hammer, 2 stars. Morkel, Doug, no alias, 2 stars. Mueller, Howard, Troll, 3 stars. Seavers, Robert, Bludgeon, 3 stars. Name unknown, Black Shadow, 2 stars. Names unknown, The Oddity, 2 stars. Name unknown, Quasiman, 3 stars. Name unknown, Worm, 4 stars. Jay considered the names that remained. Ernie the Lizard DeMarco owned a Jokertown bar, but it was strictly a neighborhood place. No competition for the palace. They crossed him out. Devil John Darlingfoot was hired muscle, with a record as long as a Joker's dork. But all his strength was in one deformed leg. Maybe he kicked in Chrysalis's face. Somehow it didn't feel right. Besides, Jay had the vague impression that Devil John drew the line at murder. He crossed out that name, too. Doughboy had tremendous strength and the mind of a child. He'd become somewhat of a cause when the cops arrested him for murder a few years back, but he hadn't done that one, and Jay didn't think it was very likely that he had done this one either. He went. Mordecai Jones lived in Harlem, half a city away from Jokertown. Except for that world tour last year, he didn't move in the same circles as Chrysalis. He went too. He hesitated for a couple of minutes over Howard Mueller, better known as Troll, the chief of security at Dr. Tachyon's Jokertown clinic. Mueller was a palace regular, and the 9-foot-tall Joker was up there with Golden Boy and the Harlem Hammer in the strength department. But as far as Jay knew, Troll was one of the good guys. Maybe he wasn't as clean as he looked. Maybe Chrysalis had dug up some dirt on him, a secret out of his past, and tried to leverage him with it. It was possible, Jay supposed. Of course, it was also a complete supposition. You could make the same theory fit Ernie the Lizard, the Harlem Hammer, Starshine, hell, any of them. What a great theory. One size fits all. No, that road would take him back to 319 names in no time at all. He put pencil to paper and resolutely scratched out Troll. That left 7 little Indians, 7 real strong Indians. Worm, Quasiman, The Oddity, Black Shadow, Bludgeon, The Sleeper, and Doug Morkel, whoever the fuck he was. Worm was an ugly bit of business, a major player in the Shadow Fist Society. Jay had run into him once, had heard him threaten Chrysalis, in fact. That had been almost 2 years ago. But Worm looked like the kind of guy who held grudges. The only problem was the M.O. Strong as he was, Worm killed with his bite, pumping his victims full of venom. Jay didn't recall any bite marks on Chrysalis, but it was worth checking. The autopsy would certainly show the presence of poison in her system. Quasiman was a caretaker at Our Lady of Perpetual Misery. Much stronger than Worm. The Hunchback was a teleport, too. He could have gotten in and out of the palace without being seen. He was supposed to be on the side of the angels. But every so often, part of his brain drifted off to another dimension or something, and then there was no telling what he might do. An unlikely suspect, but still. The oddity was one Jay already had his suspicions about. Black Shadow was another lunatic vigilante. Hated crime, and liked to kill criminals, or maybe just break all their arms and legs if he was in a good mood. Maybe Shad had learned that Chrysalis was involved in some kind of criminal activity. Maybe she'd learned his real identity and threatened to expose him. Maybe, maybe, maybe. Again, though, the M.O. was a problem. Shad was only slightly stronger than the human norm. The whispers said he was a creature of the darkness, a vampire who drank light and heat instead of blood, that he killed by draining all the warmth from his victims. He didn't break heads. Jay crossed him off. Bludgeon was a brutal 7-foot-tall joker whose right hand was twisted into a permanent fist. He'd been a shadow fist until he proved too violent and stupid even for them, and they'd cut him loose. Thanks in no small part to Jay and Hiram Worcester. That deformed fist of his could mash bone and brain real easy, and Bludgeon would probably enjoy every minute of it. The only thing was, he was dumb as a stump and twice as ugly. No way he'd penetrate the palace security on his own. And Jay couldn't imagine why Chrysalis would ever agree to meet with him. But maybe there was something Jay didn't know yet. He left Bludgeon on the list. Croyd Crenson, the sleeper, was a freelance operating on the fringes of the law. His powers changed every time he slept, but usually included super strength. And in the later stages of each waking period, he was a speed freak, given to fits of paranoid rage. Jay didn't recall that Croyd had any beef with Chrysalis, but if he was far enough gone in amphetamine psychosis, that might not matter. So if the sleeper was awake, and if the strength had stayed with him this time, and if he'd taken enough crank to fuck up his judgment, and if Chrysalis somehow provoked him into psychotic rage, Jay decided there were too damn many ifs. The sleeper got penciled out. Then there were five. Worm, Quasiman, The Oddity, Bludgeon, and Doug Morkel. "Who the fuck is Doug Morkel?" he asked Flo when she came back with the coffee pot. She didn't know either. He sighed and paid his bill, over tipping as usual. He was on his way out through the revolving door when he saw the newspaper folded up next to the punk with the green mohawk in the first booth. Jay just revolved all the way back around, walked over to the booth, and picked up the paper. "Hey," the mohawk objected. "Shit," Jay said, scanning down the column of newsprint. "They got Elmo." Riding the D-train out to Brooklyn, the story said, a goddamn guardian angel made the arrest. He bet the cops really loved that part. Jay decided that Doug Morkel would keep.
Brennan had never been inside Aces High before. It was a nice place. It seemed the kind of place where two old friends, old acquaintances at least, could sit down and have a nice, civilized chat about murder and related subjects. He hoped that Mazarik would think so too. He finished his drink and waved away the waiter when he tried to bring another. Outwardly, he was as patient as always, though inside he was as tense as a joker at a Leo Barnett rally. Mazarik was hard and tough. There'd been whispers about him in Nam when, like Brennan, he'd commanded a long-range Rakondo team. But there were always a lot of strange rumors in Nam. Brennan recognized Mazarik the moment he spotted the waiter leading him to the table. He hadn't changed much over the years. A compact man, Brennan's size and build, he moved with the same easy grace and economy of movement. He had thinning dark hair, pale skin, and intense violet eyes. He still had the air of brooding menace about him that Brennan remembered from Nam.
"Hello, Captain,"
Brennan said as Mazarik slid into the chair across the table from him. Mazarik stared at him.
"Do something to your face?"
he asked. When Brennan had infiltrated the Shadow Fists, he'd had Dr. Tachyon give his eyes epicanthic folds so he'd fit in better with the Asian gang. Mazarik, of course, had last seen him years before the operation.
It's the eyes, Captain. Asian eyes are all the rage nowadays.
Mazarik grunted and sat down.
I'm just a lieutenant now.
Brennan nodded, gestured at the waiter.
It's your party,
Mazarik said. Two more telemores, then, on ice.
Very good, sir.
The waiter bowed a precise millimeter, then left. Brennan wondered where to begin, and in the wondering they sat in silence until the waiter returned with their drinks.
Do you care to order now?
He asked, stepping a pace backward and holding his pen poised expectantly over his pad. Mazarik glanced at the unopened menu before him on the table.
I hear the black and redfish is pretty good. Though on a cop's salary, I've never had the opportunity to try it.
It's very good, sir,
the waiter said, faintly astonished that anyone could possibly think otherwise. He turned to Brennan with a raised eyebrow and poised pen.
And you, sir?
Seafood salad?
Very good, sir.
The waiter collected the menus and was gone. Mazarik took a sip from his drink, set it aside.
So, what's this about? Neither of us are exactly the type to get together to talk over the good old days we spent chasing Charlie through the jungle.
Chrysalis's murder. Mazarik grunted.
You said that. What was she to you?
We were lovers.
Mazarik's eyebrows rose. Chrysalis had a lot of lovers. You the jealous kind?
Come off it, Brennan said flatly. Why would I be talking to you if I killed her? You had no idea I was involved in this until I called you.
Murderers sometimes do strange things, Mazarik said, to call attention to themselves.
Brennan snorted.
I thought the bow and arrow vigilante was your prime suspect.
Mazarik looked at him carefully.
The playing card was found on her body, he admitted, but it wasn't the ordinary kind of card he used. This was a fancy one from Chrysalis's own antique deck.
Brennan nodded. Something that had been bothering him since his break-in at the palace suddenly clicked into place. And the rest of the deck is missing.
That's right, Mazarik said. How did you know?
Brennan smiled tightly. Someone told me that Jay Ackroyd was at the palace early that morning.
That's right, too, Mazarik said. He found the body.
Why was he there?
You're awfully full of questions, Mazarik said. You're not thinking of interfering with an ongoing police investigation, are you?
I want her killer brought to justice. If you find him, fine. If I do... His voice trailed off and he shrugged.
Look, Brennan,
Mazarik said in a sudden hard voice, pointing his forefinger at him.
None of this vigilante shit.
If you did your job, Brennan replied in a voice just as hard, there wouldn't be any need for this vigilante shit. I could be home where I want to be, instead of putting my ass on the line. Mazarik was about to reply when the waiter appeared at their table and slipped their plates in front of them. He glanced from one man to the other.
Well, that be all.
Brennan tore his gaze from Mazarik's and nodded at the waiter. For now.
Enjoy your meal, sirs,
the waiter said and hustled away. If you answer my question, Brennan said in a soft, conciliatory voice, I'll give you another one you should ask somebody. Mazarik looked at him a long time and finally sighed.
All right, I'll bite. The PI said Chrysalis had hired him to be her bodyguard. He did one hell of a job.
Brennan nodded thoughtfully and picked at his seafood salad.
Well?
Mazarik prompted.
What do you have for me?
Ask the oddity what he, she, whatever, was looking for in Chrysalis's bedroom last night. Mazarik scowled at his dish as Brennan speared a bit of crab.
You want to tell me what's going on? He finally asked.
Brennan shook his head. Not now. I've nothing you'd believe. He popped the crab in his mouth and chewed, his gaze far away. Mazarik frowned.
You better not be jerking me around.
Enjoy your meal, Brennan said. Mazarik nodded. Cut another slice.
I will. It's a damn fine fish. Damn fine.
They ate their food, saying little. Neither was much for small talk, and both were absorbed in their own thoughts. Mazarik refused the waiter's offer of coffee and dessert when they'd finished. Brennan ordered a cup of tea.
I'll be in touch, Brennan said as Mazarik rose from the table. Don't do anything foolish, Masaryk advised him.
Brennan nodded. The waiter set a teacup in front of him and left. Brennan lifted the cup to his lips. He frowned. There was a note on the saucer. It was written on a ragged scrap of paper in a childish, impossibly tiny hand. If you want to know what the Shadow Fists are hiding, it read, go to Stony Brook, 8800 Glen Hollow Road. Be careful. Brennan quickly looked around the restaurant, then immediately felt foolish for doing so. Someone had to be trailing him or reading his mind. Someone knew as much about what he was doing as he did. It gave him a chilly, uncomfortable feeling, as if he were the hunted instead of the hunter. He looked again at the note. It was unsigned, of course. It appeared as if it were sent by someone who was friendly and seemed childishly innocuous with his semi-legible scrawl, misspelled words. Brennan decided to check out the tip it offered, but also to follow its final hint and be very, very careful indeed.
2 p.m. Kent didn't look pleased to see him.
I thought we got rid of you yesterday, he said.
The reptile ranch was closed, so I came here, Jay said. Where's your partner?
Out to lunch,
Kent snapped at him.
Like you. Only with you, it's a permanent condition.
He showed his teeth. They were still pointed. Is that a joke? Jay asked. It was. He was almost sure of it. He turned to a passing uniform. Kent just made a joke, he said. The cop ignored him. I don't think he was real impressed.
You keep playing games with me, I'm going to make you real sorry, Kent promised.
His moment of levity had obviously passed.
What the fuck do you want?
He asked irritably, rubbing at a big green scab under his collar. The starch must chafe his scales. I want to talk to Elmo, Jay said. Kent was so surprised, he stopped scratching his scab.
Get the hell out of here before I throw you out.
You again? Masaryk said as he sauntered up to the desk. He was chewing on a toothpick. It must have been a good lunch.
He wants to see Elmo,
Kent told his partner, in a tone that suggested it was the funniest thing imaginable. Masaryk didn't laugh.
Why?
Jay shrugged. Might as well. Can't dance. Elmo isn't talking, Masaryk said. We told him he had the right to remain silent, and damned if he didn't take us up on it. He'll talk to me, Jay said. Kent and Masaryk exchanged glances. And you'll tell us what he said? Masaryk suggested. Wouldn't be sporting, Jay said. Kent gave him one of his sideways blinks.
Get out of here before I lose my temper. I wouldn't want you to get hurt.
Uh-oh, Jay said. You hear that, Masaryk? Your partner was threatening me with police brutality. Do all lizards have such nasty dispositions, or is it just him? Kent came around his desk. He towered over Jay, all teeth and scales.
That's it. Come on, asshole. Let's dance.
Jay ignored him. I've got a proposition for you, he said to Masaryk. Why don't you tell your partner to go sun himself on a rock while we talk privately? Masaryk looked at Kent. Give us a moment, Harv.
You're going to buy into this bullshit? Kent said.
Masaryk shrugged. He might have something. They walked down to an empty interrogation room. Masaryk shut the door, swung a chair around, and sat down with his arms crossed on its back, studying Jay with those piercing violet eyes. This better be good, he said. It's a modest little deal, but I think you'll be amused by its presumption, Jay said. You give me 10 minutes with Elmo, I'll give you the name of the Ace of Spades killer.
Stony Brook was a small suburban town in Suffolk County, Long Island. Brennan stopped at the gas station in his rented Toyota to ask directions to Glen Hollow. Thank heavens his unknown informant and managed to spell that right, road. It ran nearly parallel to Long Island Sound, and in fact turned into a wandering county road through sparsely settled, heavily forested country soon after Brennan turned onto it. A few houses were directly on the road. More stood back, out of sight, on meandering dirt lanes. Brennan kept looking for number 8800, but missed it the first time by. He stopped when he saw number 8880 on a mailbox next to a dirt lane, checked for non-existent traffic, then did a careful three-point turn and headed back down the road, this time driving even slower. This time he passed number 8700 without finding the address he was looking for, but remembered going by an unnumbered lane that could have been the missing 8800. Brennan pulled over to the side on a relatively wide section of the road. He parked, got out of the car, and went to the trunk where he had stashed his bow case. He glanced up and down the road. There was still no traffic. He opened the bow case and, with practiced assured ease, assembled his compound bow. He drew the string smoothly. His shoulder burned, but he decided he could handle the pain. He slipped his hood over his head and then faded into the trees crowding the roadside. The hunter returned to the forest.
The lockup in Fort Freak had special cells for special customers. Elmo raided a windowless cubicle with a reinforced steel door. There were unseemly bulges in the metal where some previous tenant had tried to punch his way out. When they entered, Elmo was seated on the narrow bed, feet dangling a foot off the floor. His arms were locked in the most massive pair of handcuffs Jay had ever seen. "Custom design," Mazurek told him, "for perps with more muscles than Mother Nature intended." He was using his bad cop voice, hard-edged and nasty. Maybe he and Kant really did swap roles with jokers. "Take him off," Jay said. "That wasn't part of our deal," Mazurek said. "You got 10 minutes. He locked the cell door behind him. They listened as his footsteps receded down the corridor. Elmo looked up for the first time.
"Popinjay," the dwarf said.
He was about 4 feet tall and almost as wide. His arms and legs were short but massive, thick with cords of muscle. "They tell me you're not talking."
"Nothing to say. I still got my phone call coming. Know any lawyers?"
"Try Dr. Pretorius," Jay said.
"He any good?"
"He's a pain in the ass, but yeah, he's good. And he's had lots of practice defending scapegoats."
"You don't think I did it?"
Jay sat down on the toilet. She was scared. "No offense, Elmo, but I can't imagine her being scared of you. She hired me as extra security. Told me I'd start the next day." "It make any sense if the guy you're scared of lives downstairs?" The dwarf's normally stolid features twisted in pain.
"I was her bodyguard," he said. "For years, I never let nothing happen to her. This is my fault. I should have been there."
"Why weren't you?" Elmo studied his hands. His fingers were blunt and stubby, ridged with calluses.
"She sent me on an errand."
"Then it's not your fault. You did what she told you to do. What kind of errand?" Elmo shook his head.
"Can't say. Her business."
"She's dead," Jay pointed out. "And you're going to take the fall for killing her. You think Jokertown is bad? You ought to see how jokers get treated up in Attica. Talk to me, Elmo. Give me something to work with." Elmo looked around the cell. "I delivered a sealed envelope and an airline ticket to a man in a warehouse," he said after a while. "The meeting went off without a hitch. But when I got back to the palace, there were cop cars out front. I didn't like the looks of that, so I figured I'd lay low until I found out what was going on. When I heard over the radio, I decided it'd be healthier to leave town. I didn't have nothing to go back for anyway." "Who was the man?" Jay asked. Elmo closed his hand into a fist. "Don't know." "What did he look like?" Elmo opened his fingers again. "It was dark, and he wore a mask, a bear mask, black, with big teeth." Jay scowled. "He looked strong?" Elmo laughed. "We didn't do any arm wrestling. I delivered an envelope, that's all." Then he fell silent, staring at his fingers, as he opened and closed his hand. "What else?" Jay prompted. He got no reply.
Come on, Elmo. We've only got 10 minutes. Help me.
The dwarf's face was expressionless for a moment. His eyes locked on Jay's. Then he nodded slowly and looked away.
Yeah, he said. Okay. It's hard. She...
Elmo groped for words.
She didn't tell me not to say nothing, but she never had to. I knew when to keep my mouth shut. If you didn't, you didn't stay around the palace for long. But now it don't matter, does it? She's gone.
Tell me about the meeting. The envelope was full of money, a lot of money. She was buying a hit. I knew it. She knew I knew. We both pretended otherwise. That was the way she liked to do things.
He looked up at Jay.
He must have hit her first. That's all I could figure. Chrysalis had never been a model citizen, Jay knew. She made her own rules.
Murder, though? That didn't sound like the woman he'd known.
Who did she want dead? In the envelope with the money was a folded-up piece of paper with a name on it, Elmo told him.
I never saw it, but when the guy in the bear mask read it, he made a crack. He said, shit, never ask for anything small. Then I knew. The money in the envelope was way more than the going price for a hit, and that was only part of the payment. And that airline ticket? Round trip to Atlanta.
Atlanta, Jay said. For a moment he wondered, who the hell Chrysalis could possibly know in Atlanta? Then he got it. And a cold, sick feeling spread over him. Oh, shit, he said.
She was never interested in politics until last year, Elmo confided. Then she got real interested.
I figured, I don't know, maybe some of the stuff she'd seen on the tour. She wasn't like old Dez or some of those other joker politicos, but she was a joker.
Leo Barnett, Jay said.
Elmo nodded. Gotta be. Great, Jay said. Just fucking great. For a moment, he couldn't think. Tell me about the hitman, he said. Tall, skinny, wore gloves, cheap suit. Didn't fit too well. On the ticket, the name was George Kirby. But that was just something Chrysalis made up.
George Kirby, Jay repeated. The name sounded vaguely familiar.
When was this flight?
Today, Elmo said. Shit, Jay said. Shit, shit, shit.
He glanced at his watch. His time was almost up. Mazarik will be here in a minute to chase me out. We need to hurry. Tell me about Yeoman.
Yeoman? He's history, Elmo said bluntly. He's been gone for what, a year now?
Nobody knew where, not even Chrysalis. She tried like hell to find him.
I think she was afraid the fist had iced him.
There was bad blood between Yeoman and the fists. But it couldn't have been him.
It was only a gnat.
The oddity? Jay asked. Elmo shrugged. If they had dealings, it wasn't anything she told me about.
Who else? Jay asked.
Enemies, rejected lovers, greedy heirs. Anyone who had a reason to want her dead.
She had a silent partner, Elmo told him. A joker named Charles Dutton. He helped her buy the palace, way back when she started. I guess the joint is his now.
I'll talk to him, Jay promised.
Anything else?
Elmo hesitated.
Come on, Jay urged. Spill it.
I don't know what it means, Elmo said, but last year in the spring, I had to get rid of a body.
A body, Jay said.
Elmo nodded. A woman, young, dark-skinned. Might have been pretty once, before, but not when I saw her. She'd been butchered, cut all to hell. Her breasts cut off, her face sliced to ribbons. One arm flayed. It made me sick. I'd never seen Chrysalis so scared as she was that night. It was my night off, but she found me. Called me back. When I got there, Digger Downs was dry-heaving in the men's room, and Chrysalis was in her office, just sitting there, smoking and staring at that body. Her hand was trembling, but she couldn't seem to look away until I covered it up with a sheet. She told me to clean it all up. So I did. I didn't ask no questions, and she didn't tell me nothing. After, she never spoke about it. What did you do with the body? Jay asked. Put it in a garbage bag and left it in the basement. The next morning, it was gone. The neighbors. They both heard the footsteps at the same time. The neighbors? Jay prompted. Next door, Elmo started to say as a key turned in the lock. Any bodies we left for them. They were good at stuff like that. He shut up and looked sullenly at the floor. The cell door swung open. Next to Mazurek was Captain Ellis herself, puffing on a cigarette and bouncing from heel to heel. Get the hell out of there. I was just leaving, Jay said. He gave Elmo a reassuring pat on the arm as he walked past. The dwarf didn't even look up. I want you to know that Mazurek made this little arrangement without my permission, Ellis snapped. But now that it's done, you damn well better deliver that name. And it damn well better pan out. Or you and your friend Elmo could be sharing a cell. Jay couldn't even work up the energy to sass her. Daniel Brennan, he said. Mazurek shot him a look like someone had just slipped an ice cube down his pants. Ellis just snorted and wrote down the name. Have a nice day, Jay told him, walking out.
There were no walls, fences, or other barriers to keep Brennan off the grounds of 8800 Glen Hollow Road. A few trees had posted signs on them prohibiting hunting, fishing, or any other trespass under the full extent of the law, but Brennan didn't let that stop him. He moved cautiously through the trees, as quietly and carefully as if he were back in Vietnam and the forest was crawling with the enemy. He finally broke through the screen of trees and found himself facing a rolling lawn that was as smooth as a putting green. Past the beautifully manicured lawn was an extensive flower garden. Past the flower garden was a high hedge. Past the hedge was a house, two stories. The first floor was hidden by the hedge, but four windows on the second floor looked directly upon the lawn. Brennan took a deep breath and sprinted across the open lawn, feeling completely naked and vulnerable to anyone who might be watching from the house. He hurdled the first row of flowers, landing lightly in a crouched position, and caught his breath and listened. Nothing. He looked around. Nothing but flowers. He scuttled into the garden in a crouch, keeping out of sight of the second-story windows, recognizing many of the flowers as he moved through the garden. There were roses and chrysanthemums, snapdragons and sunflowers, but planted side by side with them were poppies, like those he'd seen growing in plantations in Vietnam and Thailand, and datura, which he recognized from his boyhood days in the Southwest, and, in cool, deep-shaded bowers, mushrooms of a dozen colors and shapes, none of which looked suitable for sautéing and eating with steak. The innocent-looking flower garden, Brennan realized, was a drug chemist's dream with enough raw material to concoct almost any kind of stimulant, depressant, or hallucinogen. But, Brennan noted with a professional landscaper's eye, it was also a place of beautiful serenity, laid out with an eye toward the perfect blending of colors, shapes, and textures. Even the occasional ornaments interspersed between the rows of plants were pleasing and harmonious, if at times a little outré, like the four-foot-high concrete mushroom and the hookah-smoking caterpillar curled up on it. Not your typical garden ornament, certainly, but it fit the theme of this one. Brennan smiled, and then the caterpillar turned and looked at him. His cheeks puffed out and blew a hazy cloud of smoke, which engulfed Brennan before he could shut his mouth. He sucked in a deep lungful of sweet-tasting smoke, turned, and managed to stagger three steps. His head was swimming in unstoppable circles, and his eyes were rolling up in back of his head as he fell heavily on the thick grass. It fell cool on his cheek as the caterpillar spoke in a naggingly familiar voice through mechanical lips.
"Welcome to the Magic Kingdom,"
it said as Brennan's eyes closed.
8 p.m. The cops had the funeral home staked out to hell and gone. Jay spotted the first one selling Franks from a pushcart on the corner. Two more sitting in a parked car halfway down the block. A fourth on a roof across the street. Either they weren't completely convinced that Elmo was their man, or they were hoping for Yeoman to show up and pay his last respects. Cosgrove's mortuary was a sprawling three-story Victorian monstrosity that looked like a shipwreck from another time. It had a great round turret in one corner, a tall Gothic tower in another. A wide wooden porch that girdled the entire house. Jigsaw carpentry everywhere. Chrysalis would have loved the place. He was climbing the steps when the door banged open and Lupo came stalking out.
A bloody farce, that's what it is!
He snarled when he saw Jay. His ears were flat against his skull in anger.
Who the hell does he think he is?
He didn't wait for an answer. Jay shrugged and went on in. The foyer was darkly papered and full of antiques. The daily directory and a glass case mounted on the wall announced three viewings. Weidman was in the east parlor. Jory in the west parlor. Moore upstairs in the round room. Jay realized that he didn't know Chrysalis's real name.
Oh, said a soft voice beside him. Mr. Aykroyd, it's so good of you to come.
Waldo Cosgrove was a round, soft man in his 70s, bald as an egg, with tiny moist hands. Waldo dressed impeccably enough to please even Hiram, smelled like he'd bathed in perfume, looked like he'd been rolled in talcum powder. Jay had done some work for him the year before, when a pair of particularly grotesque Joker corpses had been stolen from the mortuary. The whole thing had upset Waldo dreadfully, and Waldo wasn't used to being upset. Mostly, Waldo was sorry. He was better at being sorry than anyone Jay had ever met. Hello, Waldo, Jay said. Which one is Chrysalis?
Miss Jury is laid out in the west parlor. It's our nicest room, you know, not to mention the largest. And she had so many friends. I was so sorry to hear about this dreadful business.
The words were right, but Jay had heard Waldo sound a lot sorrier. Something was upsetting Senior Cosgrove. What's going on? He asked. Why was Lupo so pissed off? Waldo Cosgrove tisked.
It's not our fault. Mr. Jory was quite insistent, and after all, he was her father. But some people are taking it the wrong way. I don't know what they expect us to do. I assure you, we've spared no expense.
I'm sure Mr. Jury will realize that, too, once he gets your bill, Jay said. Have I gotten any phone calls?
Phone calls? For you? Here?
I've been trying to reach Hiram Worcester down in Atlanta, Jay explained. I've been leaving messages with his hotel. If he calls, let me know.
Oh, certainly, Waldo Cosgrove said.
Another group of mourners was leaving. Jay recognized a hostess from the Crystal Palace. She didn't look too happy either. He decided to see what was going on. The west parlor was a long, somber, high-ceilinged room full of flowers. So many floral arrangements had been sent that some of them had been crowded out into the hall. A sign-in book had been placed by the door. Yin Yang stood beside it, expressing condolences to a big, robust man in his 60s, who could only be Chrysalis's father. Jory wore a white shirt and a black suit, and there was something about him that made you think, yes, this was definitely a black-and-white kind of man. Right now, he looked uncomfortable. Maybe it was the suit. Maybe it was the occasion. Maybe it was Yin Yang. Both of whose heads were talking at once, as usual. When the Joker finally shuffled into the parlor, Jay stepped up and offered a hand. Mr. Jory, I'm deeply sorry about your daughter, he said. She was an extraordinary woman. Yes, Jory replied. He had a firm handshake and a distinct twang in his voice that was utterly at odds with his daughter's carefully cultivated British accent. Deborah Jill was a fine girl. Did you know her well, Mr.? Jay ignored the question. Jory would undoubtedly recognize the name, and they'd get into the whole thing about how he found the body. A can of worms Jay didn't especially care to open. Not well enough to know her real name, I'm afraid. Deborah Jill, Jory said. She was named after my great-grandmother. Real pioneer stock she was, a genuine Sooner. You from Oklahoma? Jory nodded. Tulsa. New York's not much to my taste. Chrysalis loved the city, Jay said quietly. I knew her well enough to know that much. It was her home. Her home was Tulsa, Jory said stiffly. And no offense, sir, but I'd thank you not to call her by that name. He turned at the sound of footsteps, and Jay saw the revulsion in his eyes as they beheld Jube Benson waddling through the door, a stack of newspapers under one arm. Then his manners got the better of his distaste, and Jury forced a smile and extended a hand. Jay went inside the parlor. There were enough folding chairs to accommodate 100 people. A third were occupied, while another dozen mourners milled around, talking in soft whispers in the corners of the room. 8 out of every 10 faces belonged to jokers. Yin Yang knelt beside mush-faced Mona at the casket. The floater bobbed against the ceiling, talking quietly with Troll, whose huge green hands brushed lightly against the chandelier when he gestured, making the crystals ring like wind chimes. Hot Mama Miller wept copiously, her hands smoking as she clutched a lace handkerchief, her small face wrinkled as a prune. Beside her, Father Squid murmured consolations. Another plainclothes cop, out of place as a grape in a box of raisins, sat by an ashtray smoking a cigarette. The oddity was seated in the last row. Jay thought that was real interesting. He stared, glimpsed motion beneath the black cloth. It looked like some animal under there, squirming to get out. But it was only the Joker's body reshaping itself, a metamorphosis that never ended. The hooded face turned until Jay looked straight into the steel mesh fencing mask. He could feel eyes looking back from beneath the mesh. Jay crossed the room to where Chrysalis had been laid out. Yin Yang was just getting up. Jay stopped in shock. The casket was open. That can't be, he thought wildly. Then he saw Cosmo, seated in a folding chair, back in the shadows of the alcove where the casket had been placed. So still and quiet that he was almost invisible in the riot of funeral wreaths, and suddenly Jay understood. 3 Cosgrove brothers had inherited the family mortuary. Waldo, who was very sorry, was the front man. Titus, who was never seen, was the embalmer. Cosmo, the youngest, was the family joker. He was a frail, thin man in his 50s, bald as his brother, but patches of grayish fungus grew all over his skin and clothing, and anything he touched. And even a daily scraping couldn't quite keep the growth in check. But Cosmo had a power, too. A little deuce that made Cosgrove's the preeminent mortuary in Jokertown. He made the dead look good. He made them look better than they had in life. Jay stepped up to the casket and looked down at her. Sleeping Beauty, he thought, and knew why Lupo and the others had been so upset. She wore a simple dark dress, demure but stylish, an antique cameo fastened at her throat. Her hands were folded just under her breasts, clasping a Bible. She was lovely. Long blonde hair spread out across a satin pillow. Eyes closed peacefully in sleep, a hint of blush on her smooth pink cheeks. Chrysalis had been on the downhill side of 35, Jay knew. She looked 10 years younger now. Her skin looked as soft as the lining of the casket, so alive that you wanted to touch it, to caress it with your fingertips, to feel the warmth you knew was there. But you didn't want to do that. Cosmo could fool the eye, but not the hand. Reach down into that casket, try to stroke that blushing cheek, and God knows what your fingers would find. Not even the Cosgroves could make a head out of chunks of bone and brain.
A sad day, Father Squid said as he stepped up beside Jay.
The pastor of Our Lady of Perpetual Misery made a liquid squishing sound when he walked.
Jokertown will be a different place without her. A darker place, I fear. Do you realize it was a year ago that Xavier Desmond passed away?
Almost to the day, Jay agreed. But when Des was in here, the line of mourners went clear around the block.
Chrysalis was well respected in the community, Father Squid said. Even feared. Des was loved. He wore his heart on his sleeve. She guarded hers jealously.
He put a hand on Jay's shoulder.
The talk is, you hunt her killer.
Might as well, Jay said. Can't dance. Tell me, Father, how much do you know about our pal the Oddity over there?
Three tortured souls in search of salvation, the priest replied. Surely you do not think.
I don't know what to think, Jay said. Waldo Cosgrove was standing in the door and gesturing at him. Excuse me, Father. I have to take a phone call. Waldo let Jay use his office in the back of the mortuary. It was dark, quiet, private. He waited until Waldo had closed the door before he picked up the receiver. Hello, Hiram? The other end of the line was very noisy, but Hiram Worcester was a big man with a big voice.
Pop and Jay! The hotel said you'd call six times. Might I ask what could possibly be so urgent?
Hiram, we got big trouble. Where are you? It sounds like you're having a party.
I'm phoning from Senator Hartman's campaign trailer, Hiram said. This platform fight is dragging on and on. The least you could do is watch the convention on television. It's only the future of the country that's at stake.
Don't give me a hard time, Jay said. I'm dressed real nice. How much more do you want? Listen, I'm poking around trying to find out who killed Chrysalis.
I thought that was settled, Hiram interrupted. It was that Ace of Spades fella, the psychopath who tried to steal those stamps from us that night in the Crystal Palace.
Yeah, well, I don't think it was him, Jay said. Hiram cleared his throat noncommittally, then said,
You're a sleuth, but I think you're wasting your time.
It won't be the first time, Jay admitted. Hiram, listen to me, and be careful what you say. Little politicos have big ears. Before she died, Chrysalis hired an assassin to kill Leo Barnett. He's probably in Atlanta already. For a long moment, there was nothing on the phone but the sound of Hartman staffers shouting strategy into walkie-talkies. Then in a hoarse voice, Hiram finally managed,
Barnett? Are you sure?
It's the only thing that makes sense, Jay said. Barnett's the candidate who wants to put jokers in concentration camps. Chrysalis was a joker. Last time I looked, 2 plus 2 still added up to 4.
Or did it?
Assassinate Barnett, and you might just guarantee the triumph of Barnett's ideas. Hadn't Chrysalis been more subtle than that? Maybe 2 plus 2 equaled... what?
Hiram was talking.
Barnett's done everything he can to emasculate the Joker's rights plank. I deplore everything the man stands for, but assassination can't be tolerated. Jay, you have to go to the authorities.
Oh, that'd be real good, Jay said. Just tell them the two Jokers conspired to send an assassin, who's probably an ace, to knock off Leo Barnett because they didn't like his politics. Once the press gets wind of that, you might as well just inaugurate the fucker. Save us from all those campaign commercials.
God, Hiram swore. He was whispering now. You're right, of course. Jay, what are we going to do?
Somehow we have to keep Barnett alive without blowing the lid off this story. I'll leave the details up to you.
Thanks,
Hiram said dryly.
Ever so much.
Get help, Jay said. Someone you can trust, Tachyon maybe. Be subtle, but be careful too. See if you can come up with some way to tighten security around Barnett.
Around all the candidates, Hiram suggested.
Fine, Jay said. I'll keep digging on this end.
Jay, listen to me. You'd be more valuable down here. Chrysalis is dead. This quixotic investigation of yours won't bring her back. Start your meter and catch the next flight to Atlanta. I'm hiring you. I want you to be Senator Hartman's bodyguard.
The last body I was supposed to guard wound up short ahead, Jay pointed out. Besides, I thought each candidate had a government ace assigned to babysit.
Carnifex is an incompetent braggart, Hiram said. Nothing more than a street brawler, really. And not terribly bright. I have more faith in the Secret Service. But they're only men. At least Barnett has Lady Black attached to him. But Greg is terribly vulnerable. We need your help, Jay.
Yeah, we'll get in line, Jay said. Hiram, I gotta go. I'll keep in touch. Be careful. Do what you can.
Pop and Jay, will you listen to reason for once?
Hiram insisted.
Nah,
Jay said. It might become a habit. He hung up before Hiram could reply and headed for the door. No sooner did he step out of the office than the phone started ringing behind him. Jay leaned back against the office door and counted the rings. Hiram didn't give up easily. He had to give him that. On the ninth ring, he sighed, went back into the darkened office, and scooped up the phone.
Look, Hiram, he said, I'm not going to Atlanta, goddammit. If Senator Gregg needs another babysitter, do it yourself. You can't just...
My Archer needs help,
a woman's voice said quietly on the other end of the line. A cold chill went up Jay's spine. He knew that voice, the timbre of it, the cadences, the crisp British accent.
Chrysalis, he said, in a stunned whisper. Go to him, Chrysalis said, before it's too late.
You're dead, he said hoarsely.
Standing in the dark, the phone clutched in a sweaty hand. Jay suddenly felt like the world had been pulled out from under his feet.
The Eskimo, Chrysalis began.
The Eskimo, Jay interrupted. This was getting weirder and weirder. He felt like he'd slipped down a rabbit hole. Chrysalis was lying dead in her coffin a few rooms away. And here she was, on the phone, talking to him about Eskimos. All of a sudden, he got real suspicious. Who the hell is this anyway? He asked. There was a long silence.
Chrysalis, the voice said at last.
It sure as hell sounded like her.
My God, Jay said with all the awe he could muster. You're alive, my darling, my lover. Is it really you, sweet one?
Another hesitation.
Yes, the voice whispered at last. It's me, darling. Listen, you must save my Archer, he...
Yeah, I know. He's been kidnapped by Eskimos, Jay said. Maybe you think this is funny, but I don't. You do a damn good impression, but you're not Chrysalis. So why don't you take your Eskimos, put Prince Albert back in the can, and go fuck yourself, okay? He slammed down the receiver so hard it rang. Then he sat there in the dark, for a long time, fuming. Staring at the phone, daring it to ring again. It stayed silent.
9 p.m. Anne-Marie was 8 months pregnant with their child. They made love slowly and gently, Brennan kneeling before her. Anne-Marie lying on her side with one leg straight out, the other drawn upward. She was a slight, slim woman, now swollen to ripeness with the child in her womb. Her small breasts were heavy with milk, the nipples dark, pointed, and excruciatingly sensitive to the touch of his fingertips, the caress of his lips. Her face favored her Vietnamese ancestry more than her French, and she was beautiful, beautiful and hungry for Brennan's touch. They made love in languorous slow motion, every minute movement of their bodies perfectly mated in rhythm and cadence. And as they made love, Anne-Marie changed. Brennan watched her skin fade and flesh disappear, until he could see the network of blood vessels that laced throughout her body, and the bones and organs underneath their son in her womb. Then the baby melted away and changed, and Anne-Marie did too. She became larger, stronger, with wider hips and larger breasts, invisible but for the veins coursing through them and their dark nipples. Somehow they changed positions and Brennan was on his back, and Chrysalis was atop him. Dreamy passion on her enigmatic face, her nipples bobbing on their invisible pads of flesh as she rode Brennan, grinding her pelvis against his in long, slow, hard strokes that made him groan with each thrust. He reached out to grasp her warm, soft, invisible breasts, and they faded like smoke. Chrysalis slowly vanished, but he could still feel her warmth and wetness on his loins, and then, like a ghost, she slowly coalesced again, but her flesh was opaque. Her breasts were small and hard, her body long, lean, and muscular. "Jennifer," Brennan whispered. She smiled sadly at him and pulled away, taking all her warmth and leaving him alone and naked. He wept as the pain of her leaving stung him again and again, and she slowly faded from his sight in a haze of anguish and tears. He squinted through the blur. There was a face swimming in the mist, peering closely at him. "Jennifer," he croaked. His lips were dry, his throat tight and choked.
"About time you woke up,"
the face said in a naggingly familiar voice.
"Let's see if we can bring you all the way out of it."
Brennan couldn't move his arms or legs, but he still had feeling in them. He felt the man grab his upper arm, and then pain shot through it as needles lanced into his flesh in what felt like 3 or 4 separate places. Brennan opened his mouth to protest, but couldn't get his tongue or lips to work together. He mumbled something unintelligible, not even understanding himself what he was trying to say. A moment or two passed, and suddenly Brennan felt his heart starting to beat faster and faster. His vision cycled in and out, from misty to excruciatingly clear focus, pulsing like a strobe light. He wanted to stand, to shout, to run, but realized suddenly that he was bound in a chair with leather straps. He wrenched at the straps, but they were strong. He gritted his teeth and yanked back and forth, but the chair wouldn't budge, and the leather straps only cut into his flesh. He howled, panting in savage, unreasonable rage. He had to stand up, and the goddamn chair wouldn't let him. He'd get free. He had to. He concentrated all his strength in his right arm and yanked again and again, trying to pull free. He felt blood run down his arm, but he only redoubled his efforts.
"Sorry," someone said. "Sometimes it's difficult to judge the strength of the dosage."
He smiled reassuringly, and all of a sudden Brennan felt calm and peace flow from the man's friendly grip into himself. Brennan recognized him. He'd seen him the day before in Chickadees. It was Quincy, Kian's chemist, Quinn the Eskimo. He seemed like a nice man. When Quinn the Eskimo comes around, everybody's going to jump for joy. Brennan looked at his right arm and wondered why it was bleeding.
"That's better,"
Quincy said approvingly. He smiled and withdrew his hand from Brennan's upper arm. As he did, Brennan could see that 3 of his fingers had sharp needles protruding from their tips. As he watched, they suddenly slipped back out of sight into Quincy's fingertips.
"Welcome to Xanadu, Mr. Yeoman."
Brennan focused on him.
"What am I doing here?"
Quincy shrugged.
"You would know the answer to that better than me. One of my mechanical sentries caught you skulking in the garden."
"The caterpillar on the mushroom," Brennan said, suddenly remembering.
"Yes," Quincy said. "One of my favorites. Cost me a fortune to hire the animatronic engineers away from Disneyland. But if one can't have what one wants in one's own pleasure dome, what good is it?"
Brennan shook his head. He remembered it all now. The strange note he'd gotten at Aces High, the garden, the caterpillar, his capture, the dream. The dream. He closed his eyes. It had all been so real. Anne-Marie, the last time they'd made love before she and their unborn child had been killed by Kian's assassins. Chrysalis alive again. Jennifer.
"So, what do you want?" Quincy asked.
Brennan opened his eyes. "Chrysalis's killer."
"Oh, my," Quincy said. "Well, you won't find such a person here. This is my pleasure dome. Violence rarely intrudes."
Brennan looked around. They were the only people in the room, which looked like something out of an Arabian Nights fantasy. There were rich, colorful carpets on the floor, and brocaded silk tapestries, half of them featuring maidens, half featuring slim young men in Grecian outfits, or nothing at all, cavorting in pairs or in groups. There were numerous sculptures in a similar vein, scattered around the room on delicate, expensive furniture, and the bed was canopied, with silk and velvet cushions and throw pillows scattered around.
"I'm afraid, though," Quincy said thoughtfully, "this is going to have to be one of those times. I'm putting the finishing touches on an important project. We can't have you nosing about. Excuse me while I make a call."
The needles extruded smoothly from his fingertips again. They were white as bone, which they probably were, Brennan realized, and hollow. After a moment, a clear fluid oozed from the central one and Quincy plunged them into Brennan's arm again.
"It'll only hurt for a moment," he confided.
It seemed very quiet in the house as Jay headed back to the wake. He was surprised to find that Jory had abandoned his post by the door. Instead, Waldo Cosgrove stood there, wringing his damp little hands and looking very sorry indeed. Jay went past him, stepping into a strained, icy silence. The mourners had backed off discreetly from the two men in the center of the room, but everyone was watching them. Jory stood in the aisle, between rows of folding chairs, his face dark with anger.
"What did you say, sir?"
he asked. A newcomer stood over the casket, looking like death incarnate. Tall and slender, he wore a hooded cloak over a black wool suit. At first glance, Jay thought he was in a mask, given the occasion a singularly tasteless mask, too. Then he spoke, and Jay realized that the death's head, yellowed and noseless, teeth bared in an eternal grin, was his real face. "I said," the Joker repeated in a deep, chilly voice, "that this is not Chrysalis." He waved a gloved hand over the young woman in the casket. His words made Jay's stomach do a sudden lurch. If it wasn't Chrysalis in the coffin, if somehow he'd been mistaken about the body he'd found, then maybe she was still alive somewhere. And the voice on the phone, "I don't recall asking for your opinion," Jory said, his accent deepening under the stress of the moment. "Sir, you are causing a disruption, and I'd thank you to leave." "I think not," the man in the black cloak replied. "I came here to see Chrysalis one last time, to make my farewells. And what do I find? Some gnat fantasy lying in a coffin, and a room full of people forbidden to speak her name. Her name was Deborah Jo Jory, and she was my daughter." A vein in Jory's neck had begun to throb. "Her name," the Joker replied coldly, "was Chrysalis." Father Squid moved close to him.
"Charles, he's from Oklahoma. He knows no better. We must respect his grief."
"Then let him respect ours."
"He does not mean to give offense," the priest said.
"That makes this charade no less offensive." The Joker's eyes, deep set in his skull face, had never left Jory. Waldo Cosgrove hurried forward nervously.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen, please don't quarrel. This is not the time or the place, is it? Our dearly beloved Chrysalis, Deborah Jo, that is, well, surely she would not have wanted—"
"What I want," Jory said suddenly, "is for you to throw out this ugly son of a bitch, Cosgrove. You hear that? Either you call what passes for the law hereabouts, or I will. But either way, this asshole is going out onto the street." Waldo looked helplessly around the room, searching for some way out of this mess. Jay felt sorry for him. Finally, meekly, the funeral director turned to the Joker and said,
"Charles, please, it's customary in these matters to honor the family's wishes."
"Yes," Charles said. He made a gesture that took in all the Jokers in the room. "And we are her family, Waldo, not him. He doesn't even know what her name was." He turned his back on Jory and walked to where Cosmo sat on his chair. Cosmo looked up and adjusted his round, wire-rimmed spectacles. There was fungus growing on the back of his hand and a gray 5 o'clock shadow beneath his jaw. He said nothing. "I want to see her, Cosmo," Charles told him. "Show her to me. Show her to me the way she really was." "No," Jory shouted. "I forbid it." He stormed forward, jammed a finger at Cosmo. "You hear me, boy?" Cosmo looked at him, said nothing, looked back at Charles. Someone gasped. All eyes went to the casket. The color had begun to bleach from Deborah Jo's soft skin. "God damn you," Jory swore at Cosmo. He spun around to face Waldo. "You there! Call the police, now!" Waldo's chin trembled as his mouth worked silently. In the casket, the smooth pink flesh and hints of rose had faded. Her skin was bone white, as smooth and pale as milk. Here and there, it began to turn waxy and translucent.
"I'll do it myself, then," Jory said.
He started for the phone. There was a sound like a stack of 2x4s might make if you broke them all at once. Everything stopped. Jory looked up, and up, and up, into red eyes that stared down from beneath a huge swollen brow ridge. From his 9-foot vantage, Troll gazed down at Jory, cracked his knuckles once more, then closed his huge green hand into a fist the size of a country ham.
"I don't think that would be such a good idea," Troll said, in a voice that sounded like it came from the bottom of the world's deepest gravel pit.
All around the room, the mourners mumbled agreement. Her skin had gone all the color of wax paper, and you could see the tracery of veins now, and dark shadows of bones and organs beneath the fading flesh. Jory whirled back to the casket and slammed the lid down hard.
"Get out of here!"
he screamed, distraught beyond words.
"All of you, out of here!"
He looked around at all the Joker faces with loathing.
"You people," he said. "You all stick together, don't you? Damn you. You did this to her, you rotten."
Jay took his hand out of his pocket, pointed. Jory vanished. When the mourners realized what had happened, the tension drained from the room with a rush. Father Squid shook his head, facial tentacles bouncing from side to side with the motion.
"Where did you send him, my son?" he asked.
"Aces High," Jay said. "A good meal, a few drinks. Maybe you'll feel better. It was getting too damn ugly." The Joker called Charles stepped up to the casket and opened the lid. Chrysalis lay there now, skin as clear as the finest glass, perfectly transparent, ghostly pale wisps of muscle and tendon beneath, and under that, bones and organs, and the blue and red spiderweb of blood vessels. It was as much an illusion as the other had been, but it was the one they wanted. It was Chrysalis, as she'd looked in life. Jay's last lingering doubts vanished as he stared at the body, and with them any last lingering hopes. Chrysalis was dead. The voice on the phone had been an impostor's. Charles looked at her for a long moment, then turned away, satisfied. He patted Cosmo on the shoulder before he walked off. Hot Mama dropped to her knees, smoking hands waving in the air, and began to weep again. Others pressed close around the casket, quiet and reverent. The oddity stood in the corner, watching. Jay caught up to the skull-faced Joker as he stepped out of the parlor. "Charles Dutton, I presume?" Death turned and looked him in the eye.
"Yes."
"Jay Aykroyd," he said, offering a hand. "I'd like to ask you a few questions." 10 p.m. "I'm afraid there's not much I can tell you, Mr. Aykroyd," Charles Dutton said. A hot July wind gusted down the Bowery, flapping the Joker's long black cloak behind him as they walked. "Chrysalis and I were business associates, but I can't claim to have known her well. She liked her little secrets."
"You should know. You were one of them," Jay said. "How come no one knew Chrysalis had a partner?"
He had to walk quickly to keep up with Dutton's long-legged strides. They passed the Chaos Club, and Dutton waved politely to the doorman. "The limelight suited Chrysalis, and I prefer to avoid it," he said. "Tonight was something of an exception. I'd intended to quietly pay my last respects, but when I saw what that posturing fool had done, I couldn't help but get emotional." "Jory was her father," Jay said.
"Her beloved father," Dutton agreed,
"who made her a prisoner in her own home for years because he was so deeply embarrassed by the way she looked. You see, I do know a little of her history.
It was not something she liked to talk about, but when she first came to Jokertown, she needed my help to open the Crystal Palace. And I insist on knowing the background of my business associates.
You lent her money?
Dutton nodded. She arrived in the city with a considerable fortune in bearer bonds. However, she wanted to buy almost half a block. Not only the building that became the Crystal Palace, but the adjoining properties as well. All that debris. I don't imagine I have to tell you that Manhattan real estate is expensive, even in Jokertown. There were other costs as well. The restoration, fixtures and furnishings, the liquor license.
Bribes, Jay suggested.
A car passed them, going the other way up the Bowery. Jay watched its lights recede in the long plate glass window of the laundromat they were passing. The city inspectors work so hard, Dutton said. As do our police and firefighters. Periodic tokens of esteem are always a wise policy, particularly for a joker. Costly, though. So you lent her a lot of bucks, Jay said. He was still keeping an eye on the reflections in the laundromat window. How much of the joint did you own?
A third, Dutton said. She held the controlling interest.
Don't stop and don't look behind you, Jay said quietly. We're being followed.
Really?
Dutton was good. His pace didn't even falter. He's across the street, maybe half a block back, trying to slink from doorway to doorway, Jay said. Real amateur hour. He would have flunked slinking in detective school. He's avoiding the street lamps, but the headlights pick him up every time a car passes.
Do you know who it is? Dutton asked.
The oddity, Jay told him. Friend of yours?
I'm afraid not. I know him only by reputation.
You got any kick-ass powers you haven't mentioned? Or is it up to me? Jay asked.
Dutton laughed. Does wealth count as a power?
Maybe, Jay said. If the oddity attacks us, try throwing some $100 bills at him. We'll see how it works.
I have a better idea, Dutton said. He stopped suddenly. They were in front of the famous Bowery Wildcard Dime Museum. Dutton went up to the doors.
What the hell are you doing? Jay asked. The place is closed.
I have a key, Dutton said. He opened one of the doors and motioned Jay inside. The management won't mind.
You own the place?
Jay guessed as Dutton relocked the door. I'm afraid so, Dutton said.
He punched some numbers into a key box on the wall. A blinking red light went out, and a green one came on.
We're clear, Dutton said. Come with me.
The interior of the museum was dim and cool. They went through a swinging door and down a service corridor.
This place do good business? Jay asked. Fair, Dutton said. You've been here, of course.
A long time ago, Jay said. When I was very young, the only thing I remember is the jars. Dozens of big jars with deformed Joker babies floating inside. It really freaked me out. The memory had been buried for a long time, but the moment he spoke, it came back so vividly Jay could taste it. Endless small bodies, twisted and terrible, floating in formaldehyde behind a wall of glass. One of them bigger than the others, and especially grotesque, had been mounted on a rotating pedestal, and Jay could still remember his fear as its face slowly turned toward him. It was going to open its eyes and look at him. He had screamed, and nothing his father had said had calmed him down.
It gave me nightmares, Jay said, astonished by the sudden realization.
He couldn't quite repress a shudder.
Jesus, he said to Dutton.
Those are long gone, right?
Sadly, no, Dutton said. The monstrous Joker babies were one of the original exhibits. The tourists have come to expect them. But I have made considerable efforts to turn this into a legitimate museum since acquiring it from its original owners. And our new attractions are quite different. Let me show you.
He led Jay through an access door.
Here, Dutton said. This is our Syrian diorama.
Jay peered through the glass at a dramatic waxwork tableau. In the foreground, Carnifex was wrenching an Uzi away from a terrorist, while a pregnant peregrine raked his face with metal talons. Tachyon, dressed like a colorblind Arab fop, was out cold on the floor. Elsewhere, Jack Braun raced toward a gunman, bullets whining off his body. One of the ricochets had struck Senator Hartman. You could see the blood seeping through his sport coat. Way in back, Hiram Worcester glared up at a giant economy-sized Arab Rambo, while a woman in a black chadar held a bloody knife over a fallen prophet. I'm sure you recall the incident, Dutton said. Yeah, Jay said. From the tour. Getting wounded did wonders for Hartman's presidential campaign. It never hurts to be a hero, Dutton agreed. Jay indicated the panel of buttons in front of the diorama. What are these? Our new exhibits are state-of-the-art, Dutton said. Sound effects, dramatic lighting, animatronics. One button lights up Braun's golden force field. Another turns on the Noor's green glow. That one at the end will actually make Saeed fall. He's the giant. Worcester made him too heavy to support his own weight. I didn't know waxworks could move, Jay said. We've been moving away from wax on the animated exhibits, Dutton said. Saeed is 3/4 plastic. Doesn't he crush those other figures? He never hits the ground, Dutton said. The children love it. They all squeeze their little fists, pretending to be aces. Hiram will be so thrilled, Jay said dryly. Come, let me give you the tour, Dutton said. Only if we skip the monstrous Joker babies, Jay said. I got enough problems without running into them again. Dutton laughed and escorted him through a maze of dim-lit corridors where heroes and villains of years gone by watched from the shadows. They passed Jet Boy, the Four Aces, the Lizard King. Hardhat and the Radical stood locked in eternal combat, while a squad from the Joker Brigade stood off Charlie in some hell-forsaken part of Nam. In the Hall of Infamy, the astronomer hung from a wall, embedded in the brick with only his face and hands visible. The mortar had turned red with his blood. Nearby, Gary Gilmore stood surrounded by pillars of salt, and Gimli exhorted a maddened crowd with upraised fist. The dwarf's glass eyes seemed to follow them. Great waxwork, Jay said. Looks real. It is, Dutton said. Gimli's empty skin was found in an alley not far from here. There was no family, so we acquired the remains. Jay gave him a look. You stuffed him. He'd heard that story on the streets somewhere, but somehow he'd forgotten. Dutton cleared his throat. Yes, well, he has been quite a popular attraction. I think I've seen enough, Jay told him. Fine. Dutton took him across a cavernous hall where the turtle's old shells hung suspended from the ceiling. The adjoining gallery was still under construction. Dutton guided Jay through the tangle of ladders, tarps, and sawhorses to a snack room square in the center of the building. He turned on the lights and stood in front of a bank of vending machines. Would you prefer coffee or a soft drink? He asked. It was chilly in here, Jay realized suddenly. They must use the air conditioning even at night on account of the waxworks. Coffee would be real good, he admitted. Dutton fed quarters into the coffee machine and came to the table with two cardboard cups. He gave one to Jay. They sat. So what do you think of my little museum now? Museums are like graveyards, Jay said. Full of dead things. Dead things depress me. The famous Bowery Wildcard Dime Museum is a Jokertown institution. Jay blew on his coffee. The palace is an institution, too. Yes, Dutton said. Of a different sort. And now you own it, too. Under the terms of our partnership agreement, the surviving partner assumes full ownership of the Crystal Palace, yes. That why you had her killed? Jay suggested casually.
Dreams came again, But this time they were vague, formless things that chased Brennan through a cloying mist as he tried to find his way back to a home that didn't exist. The landscape was silent, but for the unknowable twitterings of the things chasing him. Then he heard someone softly but insistently calling his name. It was a woman's voice. It was Jennifer. He felt her cool hands on his face, and she was kneeling before him. She was dressed in a bathing suit this time, and she was softly saying his name over and over again. He tried to reach out to her, but he was still tied to his chair. She reached out and touched his bonds, and they dissolved. He tumbled forward. She broke his fall, and they both landed on the floor, Brennan on top. She was beautiful. He kissed her for a long, long moment, but then she squirmed away.
"We have to get away, Daniel. We have to get out of here before they come back."
Brennan nodded. "We will," he said. "We will," and tried to kiss her again. She pushed him away. He fell off her to the floor and looked at her with hurt in his eyes. "Just like my other dream," he said, and had an overwhelming urge to cry.
"This isn't a dream," Jennifer said firmly but lowly. "This is real."
She grabbed Brennan's hand and held it. Her hands were warm and solid. Brennan reached out and touched her face. "You are real," Brennan said wonderingly.
"I am."
She stood and pulled on Brennan's arm. He tried to stand too and immediately was struck by an intense attack of vertigo. He leaned on Jennifer, who staggered but started him shuffling toward the door. "What are you doing here?" he asked.
"Rescuing you. No time to talk now."
Brennan's bow and quiver was by the door, as were assorted knives and other items Quincy had taken from him. They stopped to pick up the bow and quiver, but there was no time for anything else. It was dark outside. Brennan wondered foggily how long he'd been unconscious. They'd just managed to stumble behind a tall, thick hedge when they saw Fadeout enter the front door, accompanied by a brace of werewolves. Brennan took a deep breath. The night air seemed to help revive him, or perhaps the drugs had simply worked through his system. He followed Jennifer under his own power through the garden. They were past the lawn and into the trees before they heard an alarm raised back at the house. "My car's this way," Brennan said.
"I know, I'm parked next to it."
"How did you find me?" Brennan asked. Jennifer glanced at him as they made their way through the trees, their path lit by the light of a nearly full moon.
"It took some doing. I spent a good part of yesterday and most of today looking through your old haunts and finally tracked you down to the hotel. But you were gone, of course, and I'd never have found you if it hadn't been for the phone call."
"Phone call?"
"Yes. She said you were here, that you'd been captured."
They broke out of the trees to the roadside. Brennan's keys were gone, so they piled into Jennifer's car and roared off down the road with Jennifer behind the wheel. Brennan ran through a breathing exercise, trying to clear his head. Jennifer kept her eyes on the road, occasionally glancing at him.
"The funny thing," she said, "about the phone call."
She fell silent and glanced at Brennan again. "Yes?" he prompted.
"I could swear that it was Chrysalis on the other end of the line."
Brennan slumped back in the car seat. There were a thousand things he wanted to say to Jennifer, but he couldn't speak. His head whirled with her revelations and the after effects of the drugs Quincy had pumped into his system. Something was wrong here, very wrong, and there was perhaps only one person who could set them straight. Only one person who would know for certain if it was Chrysalis's shattered body that had been found in her office. The man who had discovered it.
Dutton sipped from his cardboard cup very calmly. "Would you prefer that I spill my coffee in shock or just quietly turn pale with guilt?" "Either one, just so you confess," Jay said. "I'm not fussy." "Assuming that I was guilty, isn't it a bit naive to expect that I'd own up the moment I'm accused?" "Hey, it always works for Perry Mason," Jay said. "You can't blame a guy for trying." Dutton put down the coffee, took off his cloak, and draped it over the back of a chair. Beneath the banks of fluorescent light, his skin was a ghastly shade of yellow, here and there mottled with dry, dead patches of brown. "I happen to look like the popular image of the Grim Reaper," the Joker said. "Sometimes that causes people to make unfortunate assumptions about me. I did not kill Chrysalis." "Not personally," Jay said. But you had the bucks to hire it done. And you had the motive. Did I? Dutton seemed amused. The land on which the palace stands is worth quite a bit. Agreed. The saloon itself is a good tax loss. I may keep it open, and I may not. But I'd hardly kill for it. Her other business was real profitable, Jay pointed out. Tax-free, too. He took a sip of coffee. It was so hot it burned the back of his mouth going down. You own part of that one, too? No, Dutton said. Oh, she willingly shared certain pieces of information whenever she heard anything that might affect my business interests. And there was never any charge to me. That was part of our arrangement. But otherwise, her little hobby was her own. Only now it's yours by default, Jay suggested. You wouldn't want to put all those snitches out of work. Perhaps not, Dutton said. Undoubtedly, her files contain items of considerable interest, and others of considerable value. I won't pretend otherwise. Still, it's nothing I'd bloody my hands for. I could have bought and sold Chrysalis a dozen times over. I didn't need to murder her. So who did? Jay asked. I'm mystified, Dutton said. She was privy to a great deal of dangerous information, of course. But that very thing kept her safe. Alive, she could be dealt with. Kill her, and who knows what skeletons may come out of the closet. There are a lot of closets in the Crystal Palace, said Jay. You take my meaning, then, Dutton said. He shrugged. I wish I could give you something more to work on. Truly, I do. It's okay, Jay said. He took a last swallow of coffee and stood up. Well, time to shuffle home to bed. You got a back door on this place? A side exit on the alley, Dutton said, rising. Come, let me show you. The Joker led him back through a labyrinth of silent wax, their footsteps echoing down the long corridors. They were crossing a small rotunda when Jay heard something behind them. He stopped, looked back. Nothing moving. Are we alone here? Quite, Dutton said. Is something wrong? I heard something, Jay said. And I've got a funny feeling, like we're being watched. Dutton smiled. That's very common. It's the waxworks. People say their eyes follow you around the room. Jay glanced around. They were passing through the Gallery of Beauty. In the shadows, he glimpsed Peregrine, Aurora, Circe. Peregrine's eyes can follow me anywhere, he quipped. But somehow he didn't think that was it. This way, Dutton said. They turned a corner. Jay took Dutton firmly but quietly by the arm and pulled him back into a dark alcove beside a towering metal and wax likeness of Detroit steel. Jay held a finger to his lips. Dutton gave a small, quick nod. In the stillness, Jay heard soft padding footfalls coming toward them. It couldn't be the oddity. Whatever it was light-footed, as a cat, and barefoot by the sound of it. Jay shaped his hand into a gun. A shadow darted past them, faster than Jay thought possible. It was small, no more than knee-high, and it was out of sight before Jay could react. He jumped out of hiding, saw it. A hairless gray monkey thing, with too many arms, and pointed. Only it was faster than he was. It skittered up the front of a diorama, sliding over the glass quick as a lizard, and Jay popped a waxwork joker right out of his orgy and into the Aces High meat locker. Damn, he swore. He pointed again, but the monkey thing jumped before he drew a bead, swung on a fluorescent lighting fixture, and somersaulted right over Jay's head. He turned to give chase and bumped into Dutton. Where did it go? He said. Into the rotunda, the Joker said. But... Jay ran. It was gone when he hit the rotunda. But he caught a glimpse of motion down one corridor. He sprinted after it, turning the corner, just in time to see it grab hold of an overhead pipe. It paused long enough to hiss like a feral cat. then ran down the pipe into a pitch-dark room. Jay went after it. He was looking up at the ceiling pipes, running flat out. He never saw the display pedestal. It was like running into a telephone pole. Jay clutched his stomach and sat down hard, gasping with pain. The pedestal wobbled back and forth and toppled over on top of him. Glass shattered, liquid drenched him, and something soft and pale and slimy flopped onto his chest with a wet squish. There was an overwhelming smell of formaldehyde. He closed his eyes. There were footsteps behind him.
"Are you all right?" Dutton's voice asked.
"No," Jay said.
"I tried to warn you," Dutton said.
He flicked on the lights. "Am I where I think I am?" Jay asked. Eyes still closed. He thought he sounded surprisingly calm, all things considered.
"I'm afraid so," Dutton replied. "Welcome to the monstrous Joker babies. Can I do anything for you?"
"Yes," Jay said.
"You can get it off me." By the time he did, the monkey was long gone.
11 p.m. Brennan smelled Aykroyd even before he opened his apartment door. Moving with sure, swift grace, he caught him by the elbow, propelled him in a half circle, and slammed him against the wall. Jennifer materialized from nowhere and shut the door. "Keep quiet and don't move," Brennan ordered. He had Aykroyd in a painful wrist lock, grinding the detective's forearm into the small of his back. "Jesus Christ," Aykroyd muttered aggrievedly, his face mashed up against the wall. "I think you broke my goddamn nose." Brennan's own nose twitched. "What the hell have you been drinking? You smell like you've been dipped in a vat of bad booze." "Close," Aykroyd muttered as Jennifer looped a rope on his free wrist and twisted it gently to his back, where she tied his hands together. Brennan turned Aykroyd around and shoved him into a plush chrome and leather sofa that looked wildly out of place in Aykroyd's shabby apartment. The PI fell onto the couch with a loud oof and wiggled around uncomfortably on his hands. He sniffed and held his head back, trying to keep the blood that was seeping out of his nose from dripping onto his chest. He squinted at Brennan. "Yeoman, I presume? Since we're all such good friends, can I call you Dan?" "How do you know my name?" Brennan said quietly. Aykroyd shrugged. It was difficult to do that and keep the blood from running onto his shirt. "One of the first things I learned in detective school was how to find out stuff, like the names of mass vigilantes." "Why don't you just answer my question?" "Or what?" Aykroyd said angrily. He struggled to find a comfortable position on the sofa. "You think you can just come in here and—" Jennifer stepped between them. "We don't think, Mr. Aykroyd. We have," she said practically. She found a bunch of Kleenex in her handbag and staunched the flow of blood coming from his nose. She felt it gingerly, and Aykroyd winced.
"It doesn't seem to be broken."
She made a face herself and stepped out of close smelling range. "Thanks," Aykroyd muttered grudgingly. Jennifer gave Brennan a significant look. He took a deep, calming breath and began again. "Mentioning my real name to the wrong parties would cause me no end of trouble."
"Trouble?" Aykroyd interrupted. "What about the trouble you caused all those people you killed? How many was it? Do you even remember?"
"Every face," Brennan said in a slow, hard voice. He sank down on his haunches so that he and Aykroyd were eye to eye and stared at the detective. "You don't like me or what I do, and I couldn't care less. I do what I have to.
Ambushing innocent?
I can't point my finger at people and make them go away," Brennan said in the same hard voice. "And no one I killed was innocent. Maybe not everyone deserved to die for what they'd done, but they were playing the game, consciously and willingly. I'm not to blame if they were too stupid to realize the consequences of their involvement."
"Game?" Aykroyd asked. "What the hell are you talking about?"
Brennan gestured angrily. "I'm not going to justify myself to you. I'll just say this. It is—" He stopped, looked at Jennifer, and corrected himself. "Was me against the Shadow Fists. One man against hundreds. I did what I had to do. I don't regret any of it. Nor have I forgotten any of it."
"What you had to do?"
"That's that,"
Brennan said flatly. We have more important things to discuss. We don't have to be friends. We don't have to like each other. We don't have to work together. But we should talk.
Aykroyd nodded, but gestured stubbornly with his bound hands.
I'm not saying anything tied up like this.
All right. Brennan drew a knife from his ankle sheath and slashed Aykroyd's bonds. The two men stared at each other for a long moment, as Aykroyd rubbed his wrists angrily and then tenderly felt his nose. My name? Brennan prompted. Aykroyd shrugged.
All right. Sasha gave it to me. You said he'd plucked it from Chrysalis's mind. Said you were probably involved in the murder, though I figure he was lying. Something had him really scared. Why all this mystery about your real identity anyway? Other than the fact that you're wanted for multiple homicides, of course.
Brennan looked at him coolly. I'm in the country illegally. Maybe I'll explain it someday when we have a couple of spare hours. Only Wraith, he nodded at Jennifer, and my enemy knew my name. Apparently also Chrysalis.
You're wanted by the feds?
I deserted from the army. It's complicated, and it doesn't have anything to do with Chrysalis's death, if she's really dead, Brennan said significantly.
If?
Aykroyd said. What do you mean, if? I found her body.
Are you sure?
Sure? She was not merely dead, she was most sincerely dead. Brennan sighed, rubbed his face tiredly.
I don't know, he said softly. Look, you crazier than I think or what? I saw her,
and I heard her voice yesterday.
What? Aykroyd asked quietly.
And I heard her voice today, Jennifer added.
Brennan looked at him closely. What is it?
I heard it too,
Aykroyd admitted quietly.
Then he looked at Brennan and shook his head. But it couldn't have been her voice. Christ, I was just at the funeral parlor where she was lying in her coffin.
You're certain, 100% certain, that it was Chrysalis in the coffin.
Do you know anyone else with invisible skin? Aykroyd said. It was her body I found. Besides, the wise guy who called me had to be an imposter. She didn't know the real story of the relationship between me and Chrysalis, and she was telling me all kinds of screwy stuff, claimed you'd been captured by Eskimos.
Brennan sighed and shook his head. Well, she was right about that. He held up his hand, forestalling any more questions on Aykroyd's part. All right. So you're convinced she's dead? Do you have any suspects, any idea at all who killed her? Aykroyd looked at him for a long moment before he spoke.
Suspects I got. He fished a sheet of paper out of the inside breast pocket of his battered jacket and handed it to Brennan.
It was soggy and had the same horrible smell that Aykroyd had. It was a list of names, most of them crossed off.
These are your candidates?
Brennan asked as Jennifer peered at the list over his shoulder. Aykroyd nodded.
Those that are left. I crossed the others off because of my years of experience as a trained investigator and my keen insights into the human psyche.
Brennan said. Oh, you can also cross off Bludgeon. I beat the hell out of him this morning in a place called Squish's Basement.
You?
Don't look so surprised, Brennan said with something of a smile. Actually, something's wrong with him. He's obviously sick. He claimed that he killed Chrysalis, but he didn't know enough details to make his claim convincing. It was all just some pathetic attempt to rebuild his reputation.
Okay. Aykroyd produced a pen and struck a line through Bludgeon's name. I'll take your word for it. It still leaves us with four prime suspects.
Brennan nodded. I know Worm.
What about him? Aykroyd asked.
Brennan and Jennifer exchanged glances. We've gone mano a mano a few times. He's strong, but I don't know if he's strong enough to do what Chrysalis's killer did to her. Also, bludgeoning isn't his ordinary M.O.
I thought about that already, Aykroyd interjected. He likes to use his fangs, doesn't he?
Brennan unconsciously rubbed the side of his neck. That's right.
But all of us heard him threaten Chrysalis, Jennifer said.
Right, and he's one of Kian's chief lieutenants, high in the Shadowfist Society.
Kian?
Aykroyd asked. Why don't you just leave Worm to me, Brennan suggested. Aykroyd looked at him, shrugged.
Okay. You want the lizard? He's yours.
What makes Quasiman a suspect? Jennifer asked.
You mean besides the fact that his brain has more holes in it than a Swiss cheese? Well, Barnett saved his life with a faith healing, brought him back from the dead through the power of prayer. Or so some of Barnett's people claim.
And, Brennan prompted,
and crystals had someone to do in the Bible, Thumper.
Brennan frowned.
Are you sure?
Reasonably.
Elmo gave some hired muscle her order to make a hit on one of the politicos in Atlanta.
Why?
Jennifer asked.
Aykroyd shrugged.
Not sure.
Because she was afraid of Barnett's politics?
Brennan shook his head.
She wasn't stupid. She'd realize something like that would push the country right into his hands. But, he said thoughtfully, perhaps you're not the only one who misinterpreted Elmo's mission. Perhaps one of Barnett's people also found out about it and told Quasiman. At any rate, we should look into it. He glanced at Jennifer. Perhaps we should have Father Squid lend us Quasiman for a while.
For what reason? Jennifer asked.
Ostensibly in case we run into the oddity again.
The oddity? Aykroyd echoed.
I found him trashing Chrysalis's bedroom. He said that he was looking for something that Chrysalis was using to blackmail him, but I didn't buy it. Chrysalis never extorted money from anyone.
You're right, Aykroyd said.
That leaves just one name, Jennifer prompted.
Brennan looked down at the list. Who the hell is Doug Morkel?
Aykroyd shook his head.
Beats me.
Let me know if you find out.
All right. Brennan looked at Jennifer, then back at Aykroyd. That's all you got?
Yep. Except for a few questions.
Like?
Like, did you know the Chrysalis had taken up with Digger Downs?
Who's he?
He masquerades as a reporter for Aces magazine.
I wouldn't know, Brennan said. I haven't seen or spoken to Chrysalis since October 86.
Aykroyd nodded. Elmo says she was desperate for info on you.
He watched Brennan closely.
Well, we all know you're pretty good with a bow, but how about a chainsaw?
Brennan scowled. Is that supposed to be a joke?
Aykroyd shrugged. No, not really.
One last thing.
What do you know about the palace's neighbors?
Brennan was tired of Aykroyd's bizarre questions.
The palace has no neighbors, he said flatly.
It's alone on the block.
That's right, Aykroyd said. That's entirely right.
Brennan took Jennifer by the arm. We're even, he said as they turned to go.
Just so you know,
Aykroyd said as they stopped by the door.
I didn't pop you in the tombs this time, but our next meeting will be an entirely new matter.
Next time, Brennan said, nodding and smiling. I'll look forward to it.
Goodbye,
Jennifer said. She blew Aykroyd a kiss and went through the door. Brennan stopped to open it and turned to look at Aykroyd a final time. Take my advice, he told the PI, and either cut down on your drinking or switch to a better brand. You smell like you've been swimming in formaldehyde.
Real good, Aykroyd said. You could almost be a detective.
Wednesday, July 20th, 1988. 5 a.m. The sign before the rambling three-story Victorian house said, Cosgrove Mortuary, Cosmo Titus and Waldo Cosgrove, proprietors, in suitably somber, Gothic-style lettering. The building as quiet as death, as dark as the tomb. Brennan crept into the wooded porch that encircled the house, moving slowly and carefully lest one of the ancient floorboards reveal his presence by creaking in the silent night. He jimmied a window and stepped through it into the lobby. He paused for a moment and shone his pocket flashlight around the small room. It had dark wallpaper and was cluttered with antique furniture and bric-a-brac. Chrysalis, he thought, would have loved it. The directory, hanging in a glass case on the wall, listed several viewings. The one he wanted, Jory, was in the west parlor. He clicked off the flashlight and gave his eyes a few moments to readjust to the darkness, then moved into the bowels of the mortuary. There was a peculiar odor to the place, a curious mixture of chemicals and death. The silence was oppressive, unbroken by any sounds of movement or life. Brennan had to force himself to move slowly and quietly. He badly wanted to get an answer to his question
and then get the hell out into the dirty but living city air. The West Parlor was a long, high-ceilinged room, still choked with scores of flower arrangements. The flowers, like everything in this place, were dead and wilted. Their scent was stultifying in the enclosed dark. They had been placed all over the room. The most were clustered around the closed coffin that was still in place against one wall. Brennan let out a deep sigh of relief when he spotted the coffin. He was afraid that he might be too late, that it might have already been moved to the church. That would have complicated things. Brennan approached the coffin silently, stopped before it, stared at it. For a moment he couldn't bring himself to open the lid, but he had to know if it was chrysalis in the coffin. He had to see with his own eyes. He lifted the lid and held it high. The darkness made it impossible to see any details, but Brennan thought that was a good thing. He kept his pencil flashlight off. The corpse was wearing a demure dress that covered it from neck to ankles. Above the neck was nothing. The head was totally missing, apparently obliterated beyond any possible hope of reconstruction. The hands, though, holding a Bible on the sunken stomach, were clear, invisible, dead flesh. They were her hands. Chrysalis's hands. Of that Brennan was sure. The blood no longer surged through their pulsing arteries. Whatever fluid that now filled them was clear and unmoving.
It was a difficult job,
a soft voice said behind Brennan. Brennan started, almost dropping the coffin lid. He barely managed to maintain his hold on it while he turned on his flashlight and swung it around. There was the sound of something moving swiftly away from the light, and the voice spoke again.
Please, the light is painful to me.
The voice was so authentically gentle and sad that Brennan couldn't help but comply with it. All right, he said, and flicked off the flash. The speaker moved out from behind the straight-backed sofa. He was a vague, pale blur in the darkness, very white, very tall, and very thin. He smelled of strange, powerful chemicals, but his voice was as sweet as a young boy's. You work here? Brennan asked.
Oh, yes. I do the embalming. Light is injurious to me, so I do most of my work at night. I was just stopping by to say goodbye to Chrysalis. It was a difficult job, but I did the best I could.
This may sound strange, Brennan said, but you are sure that it's Chrysalis in that coffin?
Certainly,
the pale man said in his sweet voice.
Why do you ask?
Brennan shook his head. Never mind. I was just making sure. The pale man nodded in turn.
I'll leave you to your private goodbyes, even though it's past our regular visiting hours.
He turned to go, stopped, and looked back at Brennan. Brennan could see his small pink eyes shine with light reflected from his flash.
I tried to put her head back together, you know, but her killer had been terribly thorough. There weren't enough pieces to work with. I repaired the results of many violent killings, but this was one of the most savage. Her murderer deserves to be caught and punished, Mr. Yeoman.
I know, Brennan said, looking down at what was left of Chrysalis. I know.
6 a.m. In the still, sick moonlight, the fingers of the trees reached out for him hungrily as he passed. He did not look up at that grim, starless sky, where the moon pulsed like a thing alive, glistening palely with all the colors of corruption. He knew better than to look, or to listen to the terrible secrets the trees whispered in the rustling of branches, as bare and thin as whips. He walked through a land, black and barren, where dead gray grasses grasped at his feet, and the fear grew in his soul like a black worm. Huge wings of dry, cracked skin stirred the dead air. Eight-legged hunters, lean and cruel as any hound, slid from tree to tree just out of the range of his sight. The endless deep ululation sounded behind him, promising an eon of terror, an eternity of pain. He knew this place. That was the most frightening thing of all. When he saw the subway kiosk up ahead, he began to run. So slowly he ran, each stride consuming an hour. But at last he reached it and started down the stairs. He held the railing,
tight as he descended. Trains roared through mindless gulfs far below him. Still he descended down and around on steps that spiraled round forever, until he saw the other passenger. He began to chase him, down steps that grew narrow and cruel, and so cold that his bare feet stuck fast, and each step ripped away more bloody flesh, and he was there again, on that platform, hanging out over the endless subterranean dark. And there was the man before him. "Don't turn," he pleaded silently. While inside he gibbered in fear, "Oh, please, don't turn." He turned, and Jay saw that white, featureless face, tapering to one long red tentacle. It lifted its head and began to howl. Jay screamed and grunted in pain as he fell out of bed, cracking his elbow hard against the hardwood floor. He doubled over and clutched the elbow, making a whimpering sound deep in his throat. It hurt like a motherfucker. But he was almost grateful. There was nothing like a good sharp pain to chase away the nightmare. He lay there for a good 5 minutes, until the throbbing in his elbow had finally subsided. Figuring out that his childhood trauma in the dime museum had caused the nightmare didn't seem to have cured him of it. He'd wet the bed anyway. At least this time, he'd had the sense to sleep in the nude. He started the water running in the tub, then went to the kitchen, spooned some Taster's Choice into a cup, and waited for the kettle to boil. When the coffee was ready, he took it back to the bathroom. The tub was just about full. Jay set the coffee on the rim, turned off the faucets, and stepped in gingerly. The bath water felt as hot as the coffee, but he forced himself to stand there until the heat started to feel good. He stretched out in the scalding water and drank his coffee. It made him feel clean again. Otherwise, he felt like shit. Both his elbows hurt, one from falling out of bed, the other from where the psychopath son of a bitch yeoman had twisted his arm. His nose was still sore from getting mashed against the wall. He had a big bruise on his stomach, where he'd gotten mugged by the monstrous Joker baby. He drank his coffee and considered what to do with this good early start he'd made. He had his list. Down to four names now. Worm, Quasiman, The Oddity, and Doug Morkel. It had to be one of them. So why didn't he believe it? The problem was, none of his four finalists seemed real tied in with all this other crap that kept turning up. The assassins, and Eskimos, and imposters, and the agile little homunculus that Jay had chased futilely through the dime museum. He sat nursing his coffee until the bathwater was tepid, but all he came up with were more questions. It sure as hell looked like he was dealing with at least two different killers. The strong man, who'd done Chrysalis, and the chainsaw psycho, who'd butchered Digger's neighbors, just for the hell of it. Were they working together? That suggested a conspiracy. Or maybe it was just one lunatic with lots of different powers, like the late great astronomer. Someone ought to go dig up the old man's grave and see if he was still in it. But it wasn't going to be Jay. He'd been there the night the astronomer dropped by Aces High to have dessert and kill a few people. And he was perfectly willing to let someone else swing that spade. Besides, if he started considering dead suspects, he'd wind up checking where Jet Boy had been the night of the murder. Chrysalis had hired George Kirby to go assassinate Leo Barnett. If Barnett had found out, maybe the killers were working for him. Except, what ace in his right mind would work for Leo Barnett? Quasiman? Presuming he could even remember that Barnett had saved his life. Okay, so somehow Quasiman stayed smart long enough to do Chrysalis. So what about the chainsaw man and the body in the trash bag that Elmo had left for the neighbors last year? Who was that? Friend of Quasiman? Jay tried to picture Father Squid whipping a chainsaw out from under his cassock, but the thought just gave him a headache. Digger Downs was the key. but Digger Downs was missing, maybe dead. It was a real big city out there, and a bigger country beyond it. He could be anywhere. On the other hand, there was sure as hell one place he wasn't, and that was here in Jay's bathroom. He took one last swig of ice-cold coffee, grimaced, set the cup aside, and climbed out of the tub to towel himself dry.
9 a.m. When Brennan awoke, Jennifer was still asleep in the rumpled bed beside him. He was so tired that he felt as if he hadn't slept at all, and his back and shoulders were still aching from the pounding he'd taken from the oddity. He wondered if age were creeping up on him, or if it was just that he was already bone-weary of the city. He sat up and swung his feet off the bed, planting them on the threadbare carpeting of the cheap hotel room. It didn't matter. He couldn't leave until he found Chrysalis's killer. He was clear of the murder. But now Elma was the patsy. He couldn't trust the police to get it right. Of course, Aykroyd was also on the case, but Brennan had never relied on anyone to do what had to be done. He felt cool hands run gently over his shoulders and glanced backward. Jennifer was awake. She looked at him seriously as she caressed his bruised and aching back. Her hair was damp with perspiration. Her small breast and rib cage shone with it. She had wanted to accompany him to the funeral home the night before, but Brennan felt that that was a job he had to do alone. She'd been asleep when he returned to the hotel, and he'd been careful not to wake her.
"How's your back?" she asked him.
He shrugged experimentally, then grimaced. "Sore. But I can deal with it. How about you?"
"Sore," she said. "But trying to deal with it."
She moved away from him, lay back down on the bed. "I missed you."
"I missed you too," Jennifer said. "Enough at least to come and find you. You could have given me more time to think about things."
"You're right." Jennifer nodded, as if almost satisfied.
"So, did you find out about Chrysalis? Is she really dead?"
Brennan frowned. "She's in a coffin in Cosgrove's mortuary, all right."
"Then the voices we both heard could be what? Mimics? A ghost?"
"Could be," Brennan said softly, his voice trailing away.
"Then what's on for today?"
Jennifer asked, reaching out and touching his shoulder gently. He looked down at her. "Her funeral is this afternoon. I thought we should attend." Jennifer nodded again.
"What about now?"
"Now?" Jennifer pulled him down to her. She was slick with perspiration and desire. Her breast tasted salty, a tongue moist and sweet.
11 a.m. It was beginning to dawn on Jay Aykroyd that he'd wasted the entire morning. He hung up the receiver once again and contemplated his dreary little two-room office. The air conditioning was broken. The window was painted shut, and it was hot as hell. Jay was hungry and tired and sweaty, and he knew more about Digger Downs than any human being could conceivably want to know. "Except where he is," he told his secretary. His secretary stared at him with her mouth puckered in a round little O of surprise. Her name was Oral Amy, and her mouth was always puckered in a round little O of surprise. The manager of Boy Toys had given her to Jay after he'd figured out which of the employees was putting pinholes in the French ticklers, and he'd installed her at the front desk by his answering machine. She didn't take dictation, but at least she was blonde. "I've got a real bitch of a headache," he told Oral Amy. She looked at him with her face all wrinkled up in sympathy. Well, either sympathy or a slow leak. All morning he'd been dialing the phone, asking for favors, and calling in old markers. All morning he'd been lying and shucking and posing as people he wasn't to convince reluctant voices on the other end of the line that they ought to tell him what he wanted to know. The good news was, there was no one fitting Digger's description in the morgue or any of the city hospitals. The rest was bad. Digger hadn't booked a flight on any airline Jay could find. He hadn't taken Amtrak or Greyhound either. He carried a MasterCard, two Visas, and a Discover, but the last charge on any of them was a Friday night dinner at an Italian restaurant 2 blocks away from his digs on Horatio. The bill came to $63.19, and he'd stiffed the waiter. If Digger had hit the road, he'd been smart enough not to pay his tolls with plastic. Of course, he might have bought a plane ticket under an assumed name and paid cash, or boarded the Metro liner to D.C. and bought a ticket from the conductor, or escaped to the wilds of Jersey on a commuter bus out of Port Authority, exact change only, or walked across the goddamn Brooklyn Bridge. There were 8 million ways to leave the Naked City, and some you just couldn't check. There were 8 million places to stay in the Naked City, too. Jay called a half-random, half-cunning selection of motels and hotels that struck him as Digger's kind of place. He even tried a few that definitely weren't Digger's kind of place, just in case Downs had tried to be clever. Digger wasn't registered anywhere. He did find Digger's aged mother in Oakland, who told him that she hadn't heard from Tommy since he sent the flowers on Mother's Day, but she was still real proud of her boy, the journalist. She kept scrapbooks with every word Tommy had ever written, even the little articles he used to do for his high school newspaper, and said Jay was welcome to look at them the next time he was in the Bay Area. Jay thanked her very much and left his number in case she heard from Tommy. Mrs. Downs read it back to him very carefully and suggested he might phone Peregrine, seeing as how she was Tommy's girlfriend and all. Jay mentioned that this was news to him. Mrs. Downs said it was a secret, on account of Peregrine's image. His sister in Salt Lake City didn't know where he was. Neither did either of his ex-wives. Wife number one asked if he was in trouble and said, "Oh, good," when Jay admitted that he was. Wife number two offered to engage Jay's services on a little matter of alimony. He took it under advisement. His college roommate didn't remember him. The journalism professor he'd listed as a reference on his job application was entirely fictitious. The phone company had no record of any calls from his home number yesterday. Jay tried crash at Ace's just in case, but no, there hadn't been word one from Digger. Mr. Lowboy still wasn't worried. He was telling them to save space in the August issue for a real Digger Downs blockbuster. "Real good," Jay said glumly, wondering if the news of Digger's grisly death would fit Lowboy's definition of blockbuster. This time, maybe Digger was really going underground for a story. Crash asked him if he was having any luck. "Lots of it," Jay told her. "All bad. I don't suppose he had any friends on the staff there. One of the other reporters, maybe? A poker buddy, a drinking companion, the best man in his weddings? That kind of thing? Somebody who'd let him crash on his couch until all this blew over?" "No," Crash said. "He was too good. The other reporters resented the way he always got the big assignments and the cover stories. You should have heard them gripe when Lowboy sent him on that tour around the world. Digger can be charming when he wants, but he's very competitive when he's going after a story." "Damn," Jay said. "Did the guy have any friends at all?" "Well," Crash said, thinking, "he must have." "Famous last words," Jay said. "I know a lot of people thought Digger was a pain in the neck. He could be very abrasive, but he had a sweet side, too. You'd be surprised. A lot of the people he wrote up just loved him." She paused thoughtfully. "Well, at least until the stories came out," she amended. "Terrific," Jay said with a minimum of enthusiasm. "Listen," he started, "maybe you can..." His mind went off on a tangent, and the words stopped coming. "Jay?" Crash asked after a moment of silence. "You okay?" "Fine," he said. "But I just had this real weird idea."
Noon. The sun was a shiny coin flung high in the sky, obscured by a haze of pollution and a sheath of angry clouds that were motionless in the thick air. The heat and humidity made it hard to breathe as Brennan and Jennifer waited patiently in the queue that was shuffling forward into Our Lady of Perpetual Misery. Jokertown always took care of its own, and Chrysalis was going to have a fine send-off. People walked, crawled, hopped, and slithered into the church, past a couple of bored cops who were stationed at the entrance. At least the city had enough sense to assign Kant, the tame Joker cop, to this duty. But Brennan wondered what the police were supposed to detect in a gathering where masks were common. They barely glanced at Brennan, who was wearing a full-face mask, reserving most of their attention for Jennifer, who looked a lot better in black than Brennan. The church was packed, the pews already full. Brennan and Jennifer found standing room in the back next to the groaning fans that were trying to move the stifling air. Chrysalis's casket sat near the altar, covered with a carpet of flowers. There was a vast, hurried mumbling as the Living Rosary Society told their beads as they said their prayers for the repose of Chrysalis's soul. The procession began after the final paternoster. A Joker altar boy led the way, bearing a bronze helix hung with Joker Jesus. He was followed by two others, an altar boy with no visible mouth, and an altar girl with too many, swinging censers that sent clouds of sickly sweet incense billowing into the already redolent air. Other servitors followed, including priests who would assist at the funerary mass. Father Squid brought up the rear, wearing his finest surplice. It was embroidered with a scene depicting a Nat Madonna turning her back on Joker Jesus, while a pair of Jokers and a small, delicate red-haired man wearing a white lab coat took him from the helix and wrapped him in funerary cerements. They passed the front pew where the principal mourners sat. Tachyon, wearing a brilliant scarlet and gold waistcoat, sat next to a tanned, uncomfortable-looking man in a black suit. Next to them was a man with a death's head face. This last, Brennan realized, was Charles Dutton, Chrysalis's silent partner in the palace. Various palace employees sat in the pew behind them, but neither Elmo nor Sasha were present. Father Squid reached the altar, set his missal in place, then turned to the crowd and raised his arms wide and said in his sad, soft voice, "Let us pray." The mass began. It was similar to the infrequent Catholic masses Brennan had attended as a child, but with some unfamiliar twists of symbolism and ritual. Everyone took off their masks with the first prayer. Brennan looked around apprehensively for the cops, but either they'd never entered the church or were off in another part of the congregation. He and Jennifer removed their masks, and no one gave them a second glance. During the mass, there were only a few references, veiled in strange symbolism, to the Mother, reflecting the ambiguous role she played in the Church of Jesus Christ Joker theology. Praise for the Father was effusive and tainted with an air of placation, as if he were the vengeful God of the Old Testament, the God who saved with one hand and damned with the other. During communion, the altar boys and girls went out into the congregation, bearing small hampers that had been blessed by Father Squid. The hampers contained loaves of bread that the service passed out to the people sitting at the heads of the pews, who broke off bits for themselves before sending them on. After communion, Father Squid summoned Tachyon to the altar to deliver the eulogy. As Tachyon approached the rail, Brennan suddenly realized that the church's father, the small, delicately featured man with red hair, looked exactly like Tachyon. That, he thought, would make any man feel strange, but the alien's vast ego was probably capable of dealing with it. The only somber element about Tachyon's clothing was a black ribbon tied around his upper right arm. His scarlet coat, hung with gold braid and piping like tinsel on a Christmas tree, looked out of place at a funeral. But Brennan reminded himself, Tachyon was heir to an alien culture that had all kinds of odd sensibilities. Tachyon took his place behind the lectern and pulled out a handkerchief to wipe at his eyes. It was hot in the church, and Tachyon's velvet coat looked stifling. He was red-faced from the heat, and his coppery curls were damp from perspiration. His eyes, too, were red, and Brennan realized that he'd been crying. Tachyon's emotional displays made some think less of him, but not Brennan. More than once, Brennan had seen the iron underneath Tachyon's foppish exterior, and in fact he envied Tachyon his ability to show emotion. Tachyon looked out over the congregation. His expression was solemn. His husky voice was so soft that it was difficult to hear him over the thrum of the fans.
Exactly 1 year ago, on the 20th of July, 1987, we gathered in this church to bury Xavier Desmond. I spoke his eulogy, as I shall speak Chrysalis's, and I am honored to do so. But the melancholy truth is that I am weary of burying my friends. Jokertown is a poorer place because of their passing, and my life, and yours, is diminished by their loss.
He paused for a moment, gathering his thoughts.
A eulogy is a speech in praise of a person, but I am finding this one to be very difficult. I called myself Chrysalis's friend. I saw her frequently. I even traveled around the world with her. But I realize now that I didn't really know her. I knew she called herself Chrysalis and that she lived in Jokertown, but I didn't know her natal name or where she had been born. I knew she played at being British, but I never knew why. I knew she liked to drink amaretto, but I never knew what made her laugh. I knew she liked secrets, liked to be in control, liked to appear cool and untouched. But I never knew what made her that way. I thought about all of this on the plane from Atlanta and decided that if I couldn't speak in praise of her, at least I could speak in praise of her deeds. A year ago, when war waged in our streets and our children were in danger, Chrysalis offered her place, her palace, as a refuge and fortress. It was dangerous for her, but danger never disturbed Chrysalis. She was a joker who refused to act like a joker. The Crystal Lady never wore a mask. You took her as you found her, or you could just be damned. In this way, perhaps, she taught some gnats tolerance and some jokers courage.
Tachyon stopped again to wipe at the tears that suddenly ran down his cheeks, then continued with a brighter, louder voice that gained strength as he spoke.
Because we worship our ancestors, Takishian funerals are even more important than births. We believe our dead stay close by to guide their foolish descendants, a belief that can be terrifying or comforting, depending on the personality of the ancestors. Chrysalis's presence, I think, will be more terrifying than comforting because she will require much of us. Someone murdered her. This should not go unpunished. Hate rises like a smothering tide in this country. We must resist it. Our neighbors are poor and hungry, frightened and destitute. We must feed and shelter and comfort and aid them. She will expect all of this from us.
He paused, his gaze sweeping over the congregation, his eyes shiny with tears, but also, Brennan thought, with strength and hope that he had somehow imparted to those gathered to mourn Chrysalis's death. A bank of votive candles burned near the lectern. Tachyon went to it, then turned to face the congregation again.
In 1 year, he said, Jokertown has lost two of its most important leaders. We are frightened and saddened and confused by the loss. But I say they are still here, still with us. Let us be worthy of them. Win honor in their memories. Never forget.
Tachyon held out his right hand and cut the pad of his forefinger with a knife he pulled from a booth sheath. He held his finger over the flame of a candle, extinguishing it with a drop of his blood.
Farewell, Chrysalis.
Tachyon stepped from the podium and made his way back to his place in the pew, and Brennan suddenly realized that, like Tachyon, tears were running down his cheeks, too.
1 p.m. When the doorbell played, old MacDonald had a farm. Jay knew he had the right place. A housekeeper opened the door.
Yes?
She asked. Jay smiled his most ingratiating smile. Bob Lowboy, he said, holding out a hand, from Ace's magazine.
Nobody's home, she told him. Jessica's at school, and Mr. Vonderstadt won't be back from work till 7.
No problem, Jay told her.
He held up the camera he'd borrowed from his favorite pawnbroker. I just need to get a few more shots of the farm for our story on Miss Jessica and her little animals. The housekeeper looked suspicious.
That other reporter, Mr. Downs, he took all kinds of pictures.
Ruined, Jay said. A little accident in the dark room. These things happen. He glanced at his watch. Look, won't take me more than 10 minutes, but I have to get a move on. She frowned. Maybe I ought to phone Mr. Vonderstadt at the brokerage, she said. Be my guest, Jay said. But I'm due at the next shoot in 30 minutes, and you know what crosstown traffic is like this time of day. We'll just run the story without Art. The housekeeper's frown deepened.
Well, she said, maybe it would be all right. Just for a minute.
Real good, said Jay.
He stepped into the house. She led him upstairs. The farm was on the top floor. Rather, the farm was the top floor.
You be careful you stay on the path now,
the housekeeper warned him as she unlocked the special fire door.
That Mr. Downs, he almost stomped on one of the horses.
That's bigger for you, Jay said. The door swung open, and Jay looked around in astonishment. Digger hadn't exaggerated. It was Iowa, in an attic. To his right, a herd of cows munched away on a handful of real grass tossed down in the middle of a fake grass field. To his left, alone behind a chicken wire fence, a bull the size of an especially husky mouse snorted threateningly. Beyond them were other fields, other animals.
That's an elephant, Jay said. He was Miss Jessica's Christmas present, the housekeeper said. How come you're not taking any pictures?
Jay turned and looked at her. Photography is an art, you know. You don't expect me to work with you right here looking over my shoulder, do you? It actually worked.
Well, okay, the old woman said. No more than 10 minutes, mind you.
She closed the door behind her. Jay took the footpath across the fields toward the complex of farm buildings under the windows, past the flock of sheep and some very short sheepdogs, a muddy trough crawling with pigs, toy tractors and plastic farmer figurines, and a ramshackle henhouse. Chickens the size of marble squawked and fluttered at his approach. The animals weren't all to scale, but he supposed he shouldn't be picky. The house stood surrounded by haystacks, next to the traditional red barn and a tall grain silo. It was a painstaking replica of an old-fashioned wood-frame farmhouse, as lovingly detailed as any dollhouse. It had painted wooden shutters, a bronze weather vane that moved when he touched it, and real cloth curtains in the windows. On the porch swing, a plastic hired hand sat with his arm around the plastic farmer's daughter. An iced pitcher of lemonade stood on the little table beside them. Jay got on his knees and pushed open the front door with his fingers. He peered in just long enough to glimpse a living room full of antique miniatures before a tiny collie rushed out and began to bark at him wildly.
Son of a bitch,
Jay said. The dog snapped at his nose.
Nice dog, he said, pulling his head back quickly. Shut the fuck up, nice dog.
The collie kept on barking, if only he'd brought a bone.
Digger, he whispered urgently. You there?
He thought he heard a rustle of movement from one of the upper stories, but it was hard to be sure with the racket the collie was making. Jay peeked in one of the third-story windows. He saw a woman's bedroom, all lace and frills. Pale blue walls covered with butterflies, a canopied four-poster bed. Nothing moved. It was a little dusty. How do you clean the inside of a dollhouse anyway? Jay thought about that for a moment, while Lassie danced around him and yapped. He considered seeing how far he could punt the collie with a nice hard finger flick, but restrained himself. Instead, he bent over the farmhouse and lifted off the roof. Digger Downs, all 3 inches of him, was huddled on the floor of a tiny, windowless closet, trying to hide under a pile of doll clothes. He screamed when he saw Jay staring down at him, leaped up, and made a run for a staircase. Jay got him on the third step, lifting him into the air by his collar.
Don't kill me!
Digger shrieked in a tiny, shrill voice,
arms flailing as he dangled between Jay's fingers.
Oh, God, please don't kill me!
I only pick on guys my own size, Jay said. Nobody's going to kill you. We're getting out of here. Be quiet. He dropped Digger into his coat pocket, barely an instant before the housekeeper returned.
Mr. Lowboy, she said, in a disapproving tone, I have Mr. Vonderstadt on the line, and he'd like a word with you.
No can do, Jay said. Gotta run. The collie was barking up a storm, jumping around on his shoe, trying to climb up his pant leg to the pocket where Digger was hidden. You think she's trying to tell us something? Jay asked innocently.
Chrysalis's only pallbearer was a green, 9-foot-tall joker, who easily lifted her coffin and, cradling it in his arms as if it were a shoebox, led the procession into the churchyard. By the time Brennan and Jennifer had followed the crowd of mourners into the tiny graveyard, the joker and Quasiman were lowering the coffin into the open grave. Father Squid blessed the grave with incense and holy water, said the final prayers for the dead, and stepped back as Jokertown buried another of his own. A long line snaked around the grave. Each person dropped a handful, pawful, or clawful of dirt onto the coffin and paid their condolences to Father Squid, Tachyon, and the uncomfortable-looking man who'd been sitting with Tachyon in the front pew. He was a big man, with a weathered face that was florid under his tan. He was sweating from the heat and twitching from the private storm of emotions that was raging, barely checked, inside him. Hello, Father, Brennan said, taking the hand of the priest.
Good to see you again, Daniel,
Father Squid said, returning his handshake with his powerful but friendly grip. Tachyon threw himself at Brennan, hugging him with naked emotion that Brennan tolerated with good grace. He drew back after a long moment and held Brennan at arm's length, examining him critically.
We must talk. Come.
Tachyon led Brennan deeper into the graveyard until the only ones who could hear them were the carven angels on the tombstones surrounding them. Tachyon glanced back at Jennifer, who was watching them curiously from Chrysalis's graveside.
The beautiful blonde must be Jennifer, Tachyon said.
Yes.
I'd say you're a lucky man, but that would seem less than apt when you are being framed for murder. Is that what brought you back?
Partly, Brennan said. Mostly I'm here to find who killed her.
And how are you progressing?
Not too well, Brennan admitted.
Any theories?
I thought Kien might have done it, Brennan said doubtfully. Tachyon seemed even less thrilled by the notion.
That makes no sense. We had a deal that took you out of the city and ended the war. Why would he risk restarting the whole killing cycle?
Who knows, Brennan shrugged. I'm just going to keep poking until something jumps.
Just make sure it doesn't jump on you, Tachyon admonished. I wish I could aid you, but I must return to Atlanta. You will keep in touch.
Brennan shook his head. No. Once I finish this, Jennifer and I are leaving New York, and this time it will be for good.
If you want to keep in touch, at least be careful.
That I can agree to. They clasped hands, then wandered back over to the graveside. The man standing in the receiving line next to Father Squid cleared his throat, and Father Squid glanced at him.
Oh, yes, the priest said. Mr. Jory, meet,
Archer, Brennan said softly.
Yes, Daniel Archer and Jennifer Malloy. Daniel was a close friend of your daughter. Daniel and Jennifer, this is Joe Jory, Chrysalis's father.
Jory glanced aggrievedly at Father Squid before turning to Brennan and putting out a large, meaty hand.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Archer. It's good to know that my little Deborah Joe had some normal-looking friends.
Brennan's sympathetic expression went cold. Father Squid and Tachyon pretended to look elsewhere. Chrysalis was an extraordinary woman with many friends, Brennan finally said in a hard, even voice.
Her name was Deborah Joe,
Jory began, but Father Squid stepped between them and put a hand on Brennan's arm.
As executor of the estate, the priest said, I'll be reading her will tonight at the church. I think you should attend.
Brennan took his eyes from Jory and looked at Father Squid. I'll be there, he said evenly. Sorry, we have to run. He looked at Jory again. As I said, Chrysalis was an extraordinary woman. No one, as Dr. Tachyon so elegantly stated, knew much about her, though I knew more about her and her loving family than most. I promise you one thing, Mr. Jory. Her killer will be brought to justice. Not to make you feel better, but for her. Brennan turned, and Jennifer followed him as they left the churchyard. A black cab with jade green eyes was waiting for them on the street outside. It meowed as Jennifer and Brennan approached, stood on his hind paws, and offered Brennan an envelope. Jennifer stared at Brennan as he hunkered down until he was almost at eye level with the cat. The two looked at each other silently for a long moment. Then Brennan took the envelope. "Hello, Lazy Dragon," he said. "How have you been?"
"Well,"
the cat said, licked its shoulder, and then turned and ran up the street.
"Did you know that cat?"
Jennifer asked. "I worked with him once before when he was a mouse." Brennan unfolded the sheet of paper that was inside the envelope, scanned the message on it, then handed it to Jennifer. The message was short and to the point. "Hello, cowboy," it read. "Let's talk." It was signed Fade Out, and there was a phone number next to the name.
2 p.m.
"It seemed like a good idea at the time," Digger said. He was sitting on a stapler, next to a Coke can that was taller than he was. The pizza carton took up most of the desktop. Jay hadn't been able to manage more than 3 slices, and Digger was still working on a pepperoni. In his hands, it looked like a greasy red manhole cover. "The story hadn't even run yet," Digger went on. "Nobody knew about Jessica but me. And that big farmhouse looked so cozy, you know? I knew the kid had always wanted a little farmer, but Daddy wouldn't allow it. So I figured, what the hey? Nobody would know but me and Jessica. And she'd never tell. It seemed like the perfect hideout."
"Why the hell didn't you just leave town?" Jay asked him. Digger shook his head gloomily.
"Man, I wanted to, but it wasn't safe. What if they were staking out the airport, just waiting for me to make a break for it?"
He grimaced. "There's 3 airports," Jay pointed out. "Not to mention Penn Station, Grand Central, Port Authority. How many people were after you?"
"Who the hell knows?" Digger said darkly. "There's no telling who might be in on this. Cops, FBI, CIA, maybe all of them. Besides, say there was only one, and I guessed wrong," he shuddered. "I got to Jessica in her school playground, and she loved the idea. Shrunk me down right there and took me home in a Flintstones lunchbox. By then, I was having second thoughts. But it was too late. She was determined to keep me. The little snot-nosed brat wanted me to do chores. And that farmhouse, maybe it looks comfortable, but everything's made of plastic. There's no plumbing."
"There's worse things," Jay told him about the carnage at his apartment building, and Digger got very quiet.
"Holy shit," he said softly, when Jay had finished. "Jonesy and Mrs. Rosenstein, Jesus, but why? They didn't know a damn thing."
"They were there," Jay said. "You weren't." Digger dropped a half-eaten pepperoni and wiped his greasy palms off on his pants.
"You gotta believe me. I had no idea. I knew he was crazy, man, but I never..."
"You knew who was crazy?" Jay asked pointedly. Digger looked around the office. There was no one watching but Oral Amy, who looked even more surprised than usual.
"Mac the Knife," he croaked in a low, scared whisper. "Mackie Messer. You think the scene in the stairway was bad, man? You don't know nothing. I seen him kill. He did the Syrian chick right in front of us, made us watch the whole show."
"The Syrian chick?" Jay was confused.
"Misha,"
Downs told him.
"The Kahina, you know, the Nur al-Ala's sister, the one who sliced his throat open."
His tiny hands were trembling. He looked down at them and laughed. The laugh was thin and bitter, on the edge of hysterical.
"His hands shake too," he said. "Oh, man, do they shake like a blur. And then they go right through you. He touched her, you know, like he was going to play with her tit. But his fingers went right in, and the blood started. He just sliced it off right in front of us. He sliced off her tit. And then he giggled and threw it at me. I puked my guts up. Chrysalis, she just sat watching. You know how she was. It was getting to her, too. But she never liked to look weak. This is her fault. I know it. She did something stupid, right? She wasn't talking much these last few weeks, but I'm pretty good at reading people. What'd she do?
She sent a hired assassin to Atlanta, Jay said.
Damn,
Digger said.
Damn it. Yeah, it figures. She knew the score, but I guess she just couldn't stomach it no more. If we exposed him, we were dead meat. He'd warned us about that. She must have decided to kill him first.
Maybe she just couldn't live with the idea of Leo Barnett as president, Jay suggested. Digger looked at him oddly.
Barnett, he said. What does Barnett have to do with it?
Jay just stared at him.
Not Barnett,
Digger said quietly.
Greg Hartman!
Hartman? Jay said incredulous. Digger nodded. The office was hot, airless, but Jay felt cold fingers tracing a path up his spine. Maybe you better start at the beginning, he said.
Fade out, Brennan said into the phone. There was a short silence, then a voice that Brennan remembered quite well said, cautiously,
speaking?
How did you find me? Brennan asked. There was another silence, then Fade Out said,
good to hear from you so soon, cowboy. Or should I call you Yeoman?
Call me whatever you like. Just tell me how you tracked me down.
Little bird told me you were at the church.
Lazy dragon?
Exactly. I had him covering the funeral, just in case anything interesting happened. When he told me you were there, I thought I'd avail myself of your offer to discuss things. So I had him deliver my message.
I'm glad you did, Brennan said. I didn't think the Shadow Fist captain would want to talk to me. Brennan had infiltrated the Shadow Fist Society to gather evidence to bring Kian to justice. His scheme probably would have worked, but he had been forced to blow his cover to save Tachyon's life when the Fist had taken over Tachyon's clinic.
I'm not one to dwell on the past, Fade Out said expansively. You caused me a few problems, but, as I said, I think we can help each other.
Uh-huh. What would Kian say to all this?
Well,
Brennan could picture Fade Out's insincere smile.
He doesn't know every little thing that I do. We should talk in more detail. Not over the phone. Actually, we missed an opportunity to discuss things yesterday. That was you at Quinn's, wasn't it?
Yes. Sorry I didn't hang around, but I wasn't sure of the reception I'd get.
Oh, you don't have to worry about me. I think it's very possible that we can be a big help to one another.
I see. Evidently, Fade Out was an ambitious man. He might make a helpful, if not totally trustworthy, ally. Brennan checked his watch. He desperately needed a few hours' rest, then he had the will reading to attend in the evening. I'll call you about midnight with a place where we can meet. There was a long pause as Fade Out thought it over.
All right,
he finally said. Brennan hung up, sighing tiredly. He leaned back on the sagging hotel bed and rubbed his eyes.
Can we trust him?
Jennifer asked. Not too far. It sounds as if he wants to move up in the organization, and he thinks I can help him. That gives us something of a basis for working together. He doesn't know everything the Fists do, but he's high enough in the organization to know about something as big as Chrysalis's murder. Jennifer nodded.
He can give us a line on Worm. Bludgeon's been eliminated as a suspect, but there's still Quasiman and the Oddity.
I have an idea how we can deal with Quasiman, Brennan said thoughtfully. But the Oddity is still a problem. There's nothing to link him to Chrysalis other than the fact I caught him in the palace after the murder.
Rummaging through her closet.
Brennan shook his head. I can't see Chrysalis hiding anything important in such an obvious place. He shook his head in bafflement. And we're forgetting someone. Doug Morkel, whoever he is. Jennifer massaged the knotted muscles in Brennan's shoulders and neck.
It's not getting any clearer, is it?
No. And I have the feeling that if we don't catch the killer soon, he'll be long gone and out of reach of any earthly justice.
Hartman's an ace, Digger began. I knew it the minute I met him. At the press conference, before that WHO tour took off. How? Jay demanded.
Downs touched the side of his nose with a tiny finger.
The smell, he said. I got this thing, my own little ace in the hole. I can smell wild cards. Aces, jokers, latents, it don't matter. They all smell the same. Kind of spicy sweet. Nats don't have the scent. I'm never wrong. The nose knows. And it's gotten me some big stories, too. Anyway, when I got a whiff of Senator Gregg, man, oh man, I figured I'd just hook the mother of all bylines. A secret ace in the U.S. Senate, with one eye on the White House. So I started asking some questions. Chrysalis got wind of it, and before long, we were working together. We dug up a few interesting rumors, but nothing hard. Nothing I could go to press with, until Gimli dropped the whole story right into our hands. Gimli? Jay said skeptically. Not a real reliable source where Hartman is concerned. The Joker terrorist's hatred of Hartman had been common knowledge. I know, just listen up. It all makes sense. This was last year, just a few weeks after the tour came home. Gimli meets secretly with Chrysalis. In Syria, when the Nur's sister slit his throat, all kinds of bullets were flying. One of them ricocheted off the golden weenie and clipped Gregg in the shoulder. Went right through, a clean wound. But they had to strip off his jacket to see how serious it was. The jacket got left behind when we pulled out. Well, that was what Gimli brought to Chrysalis. The jacket! With the bullet tear in the shoulder, just soaked with Hartman's blood. Gimli wasn't anywhere near Syria, Jay pointed out. He was in Berlin, conspiring to snatch Hartman later in the trip. How the hell would he get hold of Hartman's jacket?
From Misha, Downs explained. After she gave her brother that second smile, she couldn't believe what she'd done. She got the jacket and had some blood tests run. They told her what I already knew. Senator Gregg's an ace. She came to the States incognito, with her evidence. She was working with Gimli.
Jay gave the 3-inch-tall reporter a dubious look.
With Gimli, he said.
We talking about the same Gimli now? Real name Tom Miller? A Joker dwarf with a nasty disposition and a big mouth? I thought the nurse people all hated Jokers.
Yeah, the abominations of Allah. Don't ask me why they were working together. They were. They wanted revenge, but they knew nobody would believe them, so Gimli gave the jacket to Chrysalis. He wanted her to check it out and then go public with it. She had the credibility. They didn't, right?
I'm with you so far.
Yeah, well, Gimli got croaked right after that. They found his skin in an alley, and he wound up stuffed and mounted in the Dime Museum. Meanwhile, Chrysalis had some tests run on the quiet, and they confirmed everything the little asshole had said. The blood type matched Gregg's, the jacket was his size, and the test showed the presence of the wild card in the blood. We had him dead.
So why didn't you go public? Jay asked. Downs looked unhappy. He got up off the stapler, stuck his hands in his pants pockets, paced restlessly around the pizza. Then glared up at Jay.
Okay. We got too fucking smart for our own good. The thing that Gimli didn't